You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege this week to welcome to Talk Nation Radio Gail Davidson. She is a legal activist working for a better world through advocacy and education to enhance understanding of and compliance with international human rights and humanitarian law. She is the founder and executive director of Lawyers' Rights Watch Canada, a volunteer-run committee of lawyers and other human rights defenders in special consultative status with the Economic and Social Council of the UN that promotes international human rights and the rule of law through advocacy, education, and legal research. Gail Davidson was the co-founder of Lawyers Against the War, an international committee of jurists and others formed to oppose war, advocate adherence to international humanitarian law, and promote accountability for violators. As part of Lawyers Against War advocacy, Gail brought torture charges against George W. Bush and pursued the right of a private person or group to prosecute torture suspects using universal jurisdiction through appeals courts in Canada and the UN Committee Against Torture. Gail Davidson, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much, David.
It's great to have you on. Great to be back in touch with you. I know you will be speaking on a conference on law and war that World Beyond War is holding in Toronto in September, and we are very much looking forward to that. And people can sign up to attend at worldbeyondwar.org. Gail, what do you make of the U.S. President and the U.S. Senate making a torturer the head of the CIA rather than prosecuting her for her crimes?
Well, this is a very alarming development, in my view, David, because it sort of marks the failure of international and domestic laws against torture to actually prevent and punish torture. And U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy called the recent vote to approve the appointment of Gina Haspel as CIA director as a referendum on torture. And sadly, I have to agree with him that by that vote, which was 54 to 45, with, I believe, six Democrats voting for and some Democrats abstaining the approval of Ms. Haspel, the U.S. Senate accepted the use of torture as something that should be rewarded instead of punished. And that's a very alarming cap on over 70 years of advocacy in the international community to ensure an end to states using torture to compel obedience and instill terror and impunity for torture perpetrators. And here we have the woman who was in charge of a black prison in Thailand where al-Nashiri was terribly tortured, now the director of the CIA. So this is a very dark day.
Many of us who would prefer to abolish the CIA would have preferred someone else be made director, and yet can't see it as anything other than somewhat appropriate that a secret, unaccountable, lawless institution that has been torturing and murdering for decades puts a torturer in charge of it.
Well, that's a very interesting perspective. Rather more hopeful than my perspective. My perspective is that it's another success by the United States to turn back to ignore the prohibitions on the use of torture by states, and that is very significant. If I can just go over the sort of back history a little bit in the last 70 years, because torture has been prohibited internationally by many, many international instruments. You know, so in 1948, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man, which is the charter document of the Organization of American States, both declared freedom from torture as a fundamental universal right that was enjoyed by everyone. And then that was followed quickly by the Geneva Conventions in 1949 and just a plethora of other instruments in the UN and the Organization of American States, the African Union, the European Union. The Convention Against Torture came into force in 1987, and at the present time there's 163 states in the world that have actually ratified the Convention Against Torture. That means that they've not only signed it but brought it into domestic law. 8 more that have signed it, only 26 states where no action has been taken. And there's actually no country in the world where torture is allowed, torture by state officials is allowed under domestic legislation. So it's quite alarming, although I see what you're saying, the irony of her being appointed, but her appointment by that vote of 54 to 45 is a very alarming development. And it sort of marks the success of the United States to override the international prohibitions against torture around the world in various jurisdictions where individuals and groups have tried to enforce the law.
Well, I appreciate, Gail Davidson, your pointing out the laws that ban torture, yes, because so many people in the United States have been intentionally confused about whether torture is illegal and when torture became illegal, despite the ban on cruel and unusual punishment in the U.S. Constitution from the beginning, and all of these treaties from the 1940s through the 1980s, and torture being made a felony in the U.S. Code in 2 different sections in the 1990s, before George W. Bush and Dick Cheney ever came to Washington, D.C., people have been persuaded that somehow torture wasn't illegal, but it was made illegal either when Bush was president or Obama made it illegal somehow, or it's just sort of legal whenever it's done, but then it's illegal henceforth beginning the next day, so it's sort of illegal, but you never prosecute it. How do we explain this to people, that torture is actually a crime and that's not a new thing?
That's a good question, because certainly until people understand that torture, and I want to keep saying torture by state officials, so I'm not, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the state using torture against people that are detained in order to compel obedience and to inspire terror in others, you know, who other detainees and other people who know that they might be the victims of the use of torture. And the U.S., just as an example of the illegality of it, after the Second World War, the U.S. participated in the tribunals that convicted both people in the Nuremberg trials and in the Tokyo trials, convicted them of torture as an international crime and sentenced them to death, actually. And the U.S. was very prominently involved both in the Nuremberg tribunals and the Tokyo tribunals, and certainly not only accepted at that time that torture was an international crime, but that it was an international crime that was amongst the gravest of crimes and had to be appropriately punished. But, you know, in the U.S., there's many laws that prohibit torture. The U.S. is a party to the Convention Against Torture, the United Nations Convention Against Torture. It's a member of the Organization of American States and a party to the charter of that organization, as well as the American Convention on Human Rights, both of which prohibit torture. It has the U.S. Torture Statute, the U.S. War Crimes Act, and so on in the U.S. And so there are no laws in the United States that make exceptions to the prohibitions that are part of U.S. law on torture. And I believe when President Obama said that they were going to look forward, the former President Obama said they were going to look forward rather than back, and declined to prosecute any members of the George Bush administration for torture, he wasn't saying the law doesn't allow prosecution. He was saying that we're exercising the prosecutorial services in the United States. The Attorney General was exercising discretion not to prosecute for torture.
Right. We're speaking with Gail Davidson, who is the director of Lawyers' Rights Watch Canada, among other things. Gail, what impact has it already had on the world, and will it have on the world, for the United States to be so publicly sanctioning torture as acceptable? What influence does that have on would-be torturers everywhere?
Well, it's had a great influence on I presume that it has had an influence on states' readiness to consider the use of torture as a means of controlling people. It's certainly, but that's a supposition that I'm making, a common sense supposition. But I can say that it's the U.S. Support for torture has certainly blocked attempts to prosecute torture. So, for instance, you mentioned Lawyers Against the War bringing criminal proceedings in Canada against George W. Bush for his role in torture in Abu Ghraib and Bagram and Guantanamo Bay. Those were the only three sites that were mentioned in that particular criminal information. And I can't say that the U.S. participated in blocking that prosecution, because I don't have any knowledge of that. In Germany, also in 2004, four different organizations, including Lawyers Against the War, brought criminal charges for torture against Donald Rumsfeld and 10 other named U.S. people. And that the U.S. was quite open in their objection to that, and that prosecution was dismissed. The same prosecution with better evidence was brought in Germany, this time by 44 individuals and organizations around the world, and that was again dismissed as not. The first one was dismissed saying that the U.S. was a better place to prosecute. The second one was dismissed saying there was not sufficient connection with Germany. The principal group that took those applications then went to the United Nations alleging interference by the U.S. And that both dismissals were politically motivated. Certainly the dismissal of the George Bush application in Canada was definitely politically rather than legally motivated, and on. So then in 2009, there was two investigations in Spain having to do with torture in Guantanamo Bay, and one of specifically of George Bush and Alberto Gonzalez in the torture memos, and the other one was an investigation actually of torture. So one was of the torture memos, the other one was of torture taking place in Guantanamo Bay, and both of those investigations were by Judge Baltasar Garzon, and who a very famous judge, passionately wanting to ensure that torture was properly prevented and punished around the world. And in 2010, WikiLeaks released quite a large number of U.S. diplomatic cables that indicated that established U.S. behind-the-scenes interference to get rid of Judge Garzon, which he was suspended, and ensure that both of those cases were terminated. So those are just some examples where political interference has been very successful in closing down prosecutions that were started by private individuals. And of course, there's been a complete dearth of prosecutions started by states, because states are not wanting to prosecute powerful states, at least, for anything, but particularly not for torture.
Political influence, yes, but a solid legal argument, no, right? I mean, the universal jurisdiction still exists. The crimes still exist. When the torture involves death, there, as some of these tortures have, there clearly is no statute of limitations. And as the United States government continues to make itself a rogue state and an enemy of the world and tear up any agreement it's agreed to, in the Iran nuclear agreement being a prominent example, does the possibility still remain of some government or group of governments or special tribunal finding the courage to advance such prosecutions in the future?
I think that there does. I'm not saying that there would be. I'm not speaking now particularly of a prosecution of the U.S. per se, but I think that there is a possibility of the law reemerging. We've gone through a period where states have demonstrated their ability to act in a lawless manner and to do so without any consequences whatsoever. And just a small example, there's many, many examples that I could use of that, but a small example is the use of torture by the various sites around the world, initiated by the Bush administration. And the fact that they were able to say, well, look, all of these people that we arbitrarily designate as being a certain class of captive, then they're not entitled to the protection of either international law or domestic U.S. law, and we'll treat them however we like. And by saying that, the Bush administration was going back to the period of the beginning of the 20th century, where states could do whatever they wanted with people within their own borders because their sovereignty entitled them to do so. And people within their own borders included people that they captured. So that was a huge setback for the law. And what's happening now, and I don't know how this, none of us know how this is going to come out, but in November of 2017, the prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda of the International Criminal Court, announced that she had conducted a preliminary examination and found that there was a reasonable basis to believe that war crimes and crimes against humanity were committed in Afghanistan after U.S.-led troops came in 2001. And so she's recommended that there be a full investigation, which what happens at the International Criminal Court is there's a preliminary investigation, and if that says there's a reasonable basis to believe a certain crime's been committed, then the prosecutor recommends to the pretrial chamber that there be a full investigation, and then at the end of that investigation, the investigative judges that are on that conducting that investigation say, yes, now there will be a trial, or no, there won't be a trial because there isn't enough evidence. But that announcement in November of the prosecutor has sparked a lot of responses from around the world. I imagine it's sparked a lot of responses from the U.S. And from the U.K., but it's certainly sparked a lot of support in Canada. A number of jurists have filed additional material with the prosecutor and with the pretrial chamber, saying we recommend that any investigation opened into the war crimes in Afghanistan being expanded to include an investigation of Canada's role. That's just an example. And those, the supportive responses by organizations, individuals, and scholars of that opening of that investigation are all reported. The behind-the-scenes objections aren't reported. So
right.
we don't as yet have any idea of what the pretrial chamber is going to do, but that's a positive development.
Indeed, an extremely positive development if it's serious, the idea of the International Criminal Court not being just for Africans, but for criminals, even if they are not from Africa, even if they are from a powerful war-making, weapons-dealing country. With the 5 minutes or so left, let me play a bit of devil's advocate.
Okay.
Why do we all focus so much on torture to the neglect of murder? I mean, the overarching crime at Nuremberg and at Tokyo was war that made the atrocities within it subsidiary crimes, as it were. We've seen the George W. Bush administration replaced by the Barack Obama administration, which tortured but took its focus to murder by missiles from robot airplanes, which
Correct.
Has been expanded upon, escalated by the Donald Trump White House, with none of the sort of moral outrage and objection that you see around torture. And it's a logical conundrum, because war supporters in the United States look at you and say, well, if murder is okay, why can't we torture people a little bit too? It doesn't make sense to them. So why this focus?
That's such a wonderful question. And I'll give you, in this small time I have, a little bit of the answer. I think that people have concentrated on torture because torture, unlike many other international crimes and international offenses, the Convention Against Torture actually has an enforcement mechanism where the convention requires states that sign on to it to prosecute torture wherever it in their courts, wherever the torture happens, and whatever the nationality of the victims and the perpetrators. And that was a reversal of the law. That was a big, big change in the law. Whereas the murder of people, which, as you say, that should be the primary thing, that could always be muddied by saying, was this a war situation? Because in war, unfortunately, people are allowed to kill each other. And within a war, the only murder that occurs is when a person such as a person who's laid down their arms or a person who's providing medical assistance is killed.
Yeah.
So
I'm sorry to interrupt, but the Kellogg-Briand Pact banned war. The United Nations Charter, with a couple of very limited exceptions, not met by most or every current war, banned war. So the notion that something is legal because it's part of a war runs up against a problem that war is not legal, does it not?
It's not legal now that the argument about whether a war of aggression was legal or illegal and what a war of aggression was as opposed to a war of defense, those were very muddy waters. I think they're less muddy now that the international, the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court has finally brought aggression into the statute as a crime, and hopefully now people will be prosecuted for starting wars. But I think that's a very long way into the distant future, legally.
With just a minute or so left, if any war is not so-called defensive, it would have to be going halfway around the world and bombing an impoverished, unarmed country and occupying it with a massive military, the likes of which the world's never seen before. I mean, that would have to be quintessentially non-defensive, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't think there's any defensive wars going on right now, in my legal opinion, that all of the wars that are going on right now are illegal.
Yeah, so not very muddy. Pretty clear, right?
Yes, that's pretty clear. But on the other hand, the education that's available to people is the education from the media, which basically still not just exonerates war, but exalts it.
Yes.
But maybe that's changing, David. One of the other complaints that's been made to the International Criminal Court recently is that
30 seconds.
Is a complaint against Donald Trump for genocide because of his threats made to North Korea. So who knows what will come of that, but those kinds of things are happening now.
That's very encouraging. I hope they advance. We will have to have you back on again, Gail Davidson. She will be speaking at the World Beyond War conference in Toronto in September. Go to worldbeyondwar.org, and we will have links and info up at talknationradio.org. Gail Davidson, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much, David. Bye-bye.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the Trump administration has announced rules further controlling the reproductive health care that women reliant on federally funded family planning programs can receive. Corporate media are reporting it as a story about abortion, but proponents of such measures would tell you their designs are much, much bigger. We'll talk about this latest attack on women's rights and its context with Kinsey Hastett, Senior Policy Manager at the Guttmacher Institute. Also on the show, there's nothing new about corporate media owners sacrificing the quality of journalism for profit, but it still feels like turning a new corner when a hometown paper like the Denver Post is taken over by a hedge fund that calls itself a specialist in making money off distress. We'll hear about the protests at the Denver Post and other papers owned by Alden Global Capital from Corey Hutchins, journalist for the Colorado Independent and Columbia Journalism Review. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at some recent press. Facebook announced it's partnering with DC think tank the Atlantic Council to monitor for misinformation and foreign interference. The details of the plan are vague, but the council has stated the goal is to design tools to bring us closer together instead of driving us further apart, whatever that means. Behind its bland name, the Atlantic Council is associated with very particular interests. It's funded by the U.S. State Department, Navy, Army, and Air Force, along with NATO, various foreign powers, and major Western corporations, including weapons contractors and oil companies. FAIR's Adam Johnson notes that what diversity of opinion exists is largely about how much and where U.S. military and soft power influence should be wielded, not if they should. But with the exception of Splinter, news outlets showed no curiosity at all about a government-backed entity telling us which news is fake or how it works when a venture supposedly meant to curb foreign interference is bankrolled by the United Arab Emirates, Japan, and Taiwan, to name a few. Not that U.S. government money is exempt from the foreign qualifier with its suggestion of malicious influence. To most of Facebook's 2.2 billion users, after all, the United States is a foreign country. The far left is winning the Democratic Civil War, was the headline over a Washington Post report on the results of recent primary elections. So what counts as far left to the Post, the newspaper owned by the world's richest human? Here are the positions cited by the Post's James Homan to characterize the unelectable activists who are thwarting Democratic hopes to take back the House, or who are otherwise part of a leftward lurch. Kara Eastman of Nebraska advocated for universal background checks to buy guns, raising taxes, and decriminalizing marijuana. John Fetterman in Pennsylvania campaigned on universal health care and legalizing marijuana. Running for governor in Idaho, Paulette Jordan based her platform on protecting more public lands, as well as promising to expand Medicaid, relax marijuana laws, reduce incarceration, and limit corporate tax loopholes. Some candidates were implicitly placed on the far left by the fact that they successfully challenged Democratic moderates, thus causing what the Post called a new bout of heartburn among party strategists. For example, Pennsylvania congressional candidate Susan Wild was worrisome because she defeated John Morganelli, who, the Post notes, opposes abortion rights and sanctuary cities, and whom Wild criticized for speaking positively about Trump and tweeting that he was open to taking a job in the administration. You know, like moderates do. As for those far-left issues, the latest polling from CBS News found 56% in favor of raising taxes on large corporations, 58% wanting higher taxes for wealthy Americans. As for marijuana, broad majorities are in favor of legalizing it. Gallup found 64%, and 53% told Kaiser they favored a national health plan. A recent Marist poll actually asked people if they would vote for or against a congressional candidate who wanted to require universal background checks for gun purchases. 86% said they would vote definitely for a candidate who took what the Washington Post calls a far-left position. One starts to get the suspicion that these candidates are not really far-left at all, and that Jeff Bezos' post would just very much like to scare you away from voting for them. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. People like to say the devil is in the details. For its account of the Trump administration's proposed changes to rules around family planning programs, the New York Times headline, "Trump rule would bar some abortion advice at federally funded clinics," suggests details might be where it's at. It's just some advice at some clinics. Even more so, the headline chosen by the Washington Post, "Is it a gag rule after all? A closer look at changes to Title X funding regarding abortion." But what if the devil, as it were, is in the big picture? If the measures chipping away at women's reproductive rights, waiting periods, notification requirements, clinic closings, were all of a piece, and this new rule requiring a bright line of physical and financial separation between Title X family planning programs and those in which abortion is supported or referred, is simply another tool in an agenda that is most usefully addressed by media at its root. Coverage focused too hard on branch. The Post gives credulous attention to supposed distinctions between abortion counseling and referral, leaves untested certain unspoken premises. That abortion is not health care, and so it's reasonable to segregate it. That women's bodies, and especially poor women's bodies, are ultimately socially owned, and so it's reasonable for others to debate and decide what happens to them. And that even though nearly one in four women in the U.S. will have an abortion, it's okay to leave the subject shrouded in stigma, suffering, and misinformation. The changes around federal family planning funding offer as good a chance as any to recenter the conversation around reproductive rights. We're joined now by Kinsey Hastett, a senior policy manager in the Guttmacher Institute's Washington, D.C. office. She joins us by phone from D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Kinsey Hastett.
Hi there, Janine. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, by saying media should address the various predations on reproductive rights as being related, I don't mean to say, of course, that we shouldn't get right the precise implications and impacts of each of those predations. I know that the language on this latest proposed rule has just come out, but from what you have seen, what do you think it would mean on the ground?
I think there's absolutely no question that the proposal we've seen from the Trump administration is very much a revival of the domestic gag rule as first proposed by President Reagan. It would indeed exclude safety net health centers that also offer abortion using non-federal funds and would do so by requiring extensive physical and financial separation. And for the record, as you have noted, abortion is very much legal. And it is also perfectly legal for clinics to offer that service using separate funds in the same space that they offer Title X supported family planning care. It also would ban referral for abortion and actually call on providers to actively mislead their patients who have expressed a desire to seek abortion services by giving them lists of providers who offer different comprehensive care and not denoting which ones are actually offering abortion services. It also requires that pregnant patients be referred for prenatal services and other care related to delivery, regardless of their wishes. And it also undermines the provision of comprehensive and unbiased information on all of a patient's pregnancy options, removing the guarantee that all patients seen through this program currently have that they would be able to receive such non-directive counseling. I think additionally, the rule that we have seen so far goes further, too. It's really making clear that at the heart of this effort from the Trump administration is an intent to totally reshape the network of entities and the scope of services that have long been supported by this Title X publicly funded family planning program. They are seeking to disadvantage providers who focus on reproductive health, which includes but is not limited to Planned Parenthood, and in fact are opening the door to Title X funds to ideologically motivated entities that are actually unwilling or unable to provide a broad range of contraceptive method options. These rules also promote other ideologically motivated approaches to family planning, such as abstinence until marriage, and take away the guarantee of contraceptive access for many patients, I think, by redefining family planning. And I appreciate the, you know, wanting to understand both this rule, but connect it to a much broader, at this point, relentless and coercive assault that we are seeing from the Trump administration against individuals' sexual and reproductive health and rights. Because at the end of the day, we are talking about denying patients the highest standard of family planning care. And we are talking about denying women access to information and services that are necessary in their own right to self-determination.
Let me just draw out as a point of information, Title X, the 1970 statute that created these federally funded family planning programs, already doesn't cover abortion services. The law already prohibits federal funds from covering abortion. Let's just say that, right?
Yes, for sure. Since the program's inception in 1970, Title X funds have always been prohibited from going toward abortion services. And currently, entities that receive Title X funds must already demonstrate that they are keeping those funds and the family planning services they support quite separate from any abortion services they may provide.
That's why I think media coverage that just narrowly dives into this latest thing that was said and doesn't give you that context is so deeply misleading. And also, I think that the Trump White House gains a lot of leverage, and I, you know, charge media with this as well, from sort of threatening something and then doing something that looks like a little bit different, and there's kind of a sigh of relief, it was going to be this, and then it turned out to be something less. Of course, we want details, but in some ways, that focus on details loses what's really happening.
Absolutely. I think it's essential to step back and see the forest for the trees. In all manner of regard, we have seen the Trump administration and social conservatives in Congress really advancing a coercive agenda against individuals' reproductive health and rights. Everything from seeking to roll back affordable health insurance coverage, both in the private and the public markets, undermining people's access to affordable contraceptive coverage under the ACA, trying to undercut comprehensive sex education programs, and now this most recent attack on publicly funded family planning. I think there are any number of fronts on which we're seeing this attack, and it's unconscionable and it's relentless.
Yeah, and in the same way that isolating rhetorically abortion in the way that the folks who are opposing it are not isolating it, it really is a part of a bigger agenda for them. I also find it odd that media tend to report abortion and reproductive health as though it only had meaning for pregnant women, you know, when, of course, policies determining whether a person has the right to decide when and if she gives birth, that's about all women, you know. It's a much broader issue, and the tendency to sort of make it very specific. And even in this case, you could read this current media coverage and think, oh, well, I'm not going to be going to a Title X clinic, you know, so this news doesn't impact me. That's a concern.
Absolutely. Well, and I think, you know, it has been additionally notable that much of the media coverage has focused on the abortion aspect of this, which is a frame being advanced by anti-abortion advocates and policymakers, when in reality, this particular vein of attack is very much focused on contraceptive care, is focused on people's access to whatever methods of birth control are going to work best for them. And so even in trying to go after abortion and framing it as such, I think in a lot of places, the fact that this is really an effort to undermine people's access to birth control and related preventive services is getting a bit lost.
Well, Media Matters' Sharon Cann found that Fox News was responsible for 54% of all the segments about abortion on evening cable news. There seems to be in media, and there's an anti-abortion space, but there's no pro-abortion space, you know. So I feel like right-wingers get to say that abortion should be a source of pain and stigma and silence and suffering. And then liberals get to say, but legal. And FAIR Research has found that as the restrictions on reproductive rights go up, the sheer amount of coverage tends to go down. And in that silence, misinformation can grow like mildew, you know, including just simple medical, biological misinformation. I just wonder, what are some to you of the most misunderstood aspects of your work area of publicly funded family planning programs? What frustrates you when you come up against the way people misunderstand things?
You know, I think one of the pieces, again, that often gets lost in the narrative are the people who rely on publicly funded family planning for care. Because at the end of the day, I can sit in DC and dissect words and we can pontificate, but where the rubber meets the road is for people who rely on these publicly funded programs and providers and have found providers that they trust. The whole point of Title X in the beginning was to kind of close the resource gap between women and couples who have more resources and those who have less and face systemic barriers to accessing affordable and high-quality care. Because everyone has the right to determine for themselves whether and when to have children, whether and when to become pregnant, and to maintain a healthy, you know, sex life. And I think when we are talking about all of these various and sundry attacks, and as policymakers exercise them on publicly funded programs, which is, of course, where they have the most authority, ultimately we are jeopardizing the health and well-being of millions of people who are largely low income, largely people of color, and people who are otherwise underserved and have faced so many barriers to getting care, and some even who have experienced historic coercion when it comes to reproductive health. And so when we are talking about imposing subpar standards of care or forcing providers to mislead their patients in this context, it's incredibly troubling and, in fact, I would say offensive.
Well, I understand some 20 state attorneys general support a nationwide preliminary injunction to stop Trump from reducing access to Title X. In practical terms, what do you think may happen next? What does the resistance or pushback look like?
I think only time will tell. We have to see over the next couple of months how all of this rolls out. The Trump administration first advanced new criteria to assess applications for these Title X grants earlier this year, which, as you point out, prompted lawsuits from a couple of organizations. And so what happens to those lawsuits will matter. You know, which type of entities apply for Title X funding will matter. Those applications actually happen to be due today. So we'll see how this network starts to shape up over the course of the next few months or how it might change. And then I think when we see these proposed regulations actually published in the Federal Register, if they look like this draft does, there will be mass outcry from professional medical associations, public health experts, providers, advocates, and people themselves.
We've been speaking with Kinsey Hastett, Senior Policy Manager at the Guttmacher Institute. You can find their work online at guttmacher.org. Thank you so much, Kinsey Hastett, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
Since hedge fund Alden Global Capital has taken control of the Denver Post, the paper has seen rounds of layoffs. The newsroom has gone from 200 or so people to more like 70, with 30 more jobs slated to be cut this summer. Journalists have been moved to the printing plant to further cut costs for Alden, whose founder, Randall Smith, describes himself as investing in distress. Denver Post workers protesting the unceremonious gutting of their newspaper were joined recently by journalists from some of the other 90-odd papers Alden controls via ownership of Digital First Media at a rally at the Vulture Fund's HQ in New York City. In a New York Times account, the Denver Post's Elizabeth Hernandez says, as reporters do, that she doesn't like being the story, but she adds, quote, "If we don't tell our own story now, I don't know how long we'll be able to tell our communities," close quote. Corey Hutchins is a journalist for the Colorado Independent, as well as a correspondent for Columbia Journalism Review's United States Project. He joins us now by phone from Denver. Welcome to Counterspin, Corey Hutchins.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, the story of the Denver Post has not been front page news, if I can say it that way, around the country. A few national pieces have appeared, like that one in the New York Times. But I wonder if people maybe see it as a local story, which it is and it isn't, right? How would you put what's happening at the Post in context for people outside Colorado?
I think right now what's happening in Denver, what's happening to the Denver Post and a lot of its sister papers throughout Colorado, which there are about a dozen smaller daily and smaller weekly papers also owned by Digital First Media in Colorado. What's happening, though, in Denver, I think, is becoming a national story. Now, I write about the media for CJR and for the Colorado Independent. So, you know, I'm seeking out these stories, and I write a weekly newsletter about the media in Colorado. And the past 3 weeks, it's been a lot more work because I'm actually reading tons of stories in larger magazines on both coasts and in other states about what's going on at the Denver Post. I'm sure a lot of the media about this is being consumed by people who pay very close attention to media and media criticism, but I do think that there's going to be some spillover into the mainstream population and mainstream news consumers. One of the things that's pushing that is the public activism that the journalists and their allies, you know, are creating, protesting outside of their newsrooms. They're getting the TV coverage locally and nationally on that. Here in Denver, the community is aware of what's going on. How broad that becomes across the country is a big question.
Well, you interviewed Julie Reynolds, the independent reporter who's really tracked the story of Alden Global Capital and its CEO, Randall Smith, and traced where it's taking money from and where that money's going. And I was struck by her description of what it was like working for a DFM paper, the Monterey Herald. And I'm not saying it's unique to DFM, but she talked about not being able to get a manila folder, you know, and reporters buying their own pens, you know. But then I was struck particularly by, she mentioned demands that reporters all of a sudden need to get out 3 stories a day with their name on them, quote, even if you rewrote a press release, close quote. So there's a direct line. We're talking about how to keep the public interested. There's a direct line between cost cutting in the newsroom and, you know, crap in the newspaper, isn't there? That's a relationship.
Beyond just the pressure on reporters to have to do more, and out of the Denver Post, you know, I wrote a story for CJR about how at one point there were basically byline quotas. It's this whole thing about, you know, we've got to do more with less. I will say the Denver Post still does really quality journalism, and they should be really proud about that.
Industry watcher Jack Schaefer says it's kind of silly to be mad at Alden. They're a money-making company making money. And anyway, it's readers who are responsible for the death of newspapers because they don't buy them anymore. In his words, Smith may be a rapacious fellow, but his primary crime is recognizing that print is approaching its expiration date and is acting on the fact that more value can be extracted by sucking the marrow than by investing more deeply or selling. Is that cynical? Is that true? Is that both? What do you make of that attitude as we go forward?
That argument is kind of the one that's also being pushed by corporate people at Digital First Media and the editor of the Denver Post, who basically says, hey, it's not so much that a hedge fund owns the newspaper. The reason we're downsizing and laying off reporters is really only because of market forces. It's because our subscription rates are shrinking and so is our advertising revenue. Now, that is true. Their subscription rates probably are shrinking and their advertising revenue is declining. Now, the other side of that is folks who say, well, that's happening at other newspapers too, but those papers are also willing to accept a lower profit margin than the newspapers owned by Digital First Media, who, according to national newspaper analyst Ken Doctor, have really high double-digit profits that he says are better than their peers. You do have this nationwide problem of print declining because of ad revenues and less people subscribing. And I think it's exasperated at the papers owned by Digital First Media because their hedge fund wants these massive profits. Kind of creates a perfect storm if you're, you know, working for a paper like that.
Absolutely. People say it's okay that newspapers are dying because the internet. And I just wonder, what do you think would be lost if, for example, the Denver Post were to be starved into non-existence eventually? What gets lost when we lose papers?
Bottom line, information. If the Denver Post goes away, it'll be the first major city of its size without a local newspaper. I think that would be disastrous. There was a lawmaker who was quoted by a public radio station, a reporter who was kind of going around and asking for reactions at the legislature. What do you think about all this stuff at the Denver Post? And she overheard some lawmaker joke, well, I guess it means we'll be able to do whatever we want now. That may have been a joke, but I think that's a pretty sad commentary and kind of crystallizes the worst of the worst that would happen, right? You've got less people doing journalism in a city like this than the truth is we don't know what we don't know, and that thought's pretty scary.
We've been speaking with Corey Hutchins, reporter for the Colorado Independent and Columbia Journalism Review. Thank you so much, Corey Hutchins, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. Anytime.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
We live in a strange time of techno myths and ways to profit from unthinkable destruction. In this program, I call forward two witnesses from places unknown to mainstream media. We start with another rambling lie told about carbon emissions and climate change. Scientist Mary Booth says the new drive to burn wood as a replacement for coal is backfiring in the atmosphere. Then activist Jay Coghlan explains the arcane world of plutonium pits, the core trigger for weapons of mass incineration. The Trump administration promises to make lots more of them in South Carolina and in New Mexico, even though America literally has tons of them stored away unused in Texas warehouses. If you like ultimate gambling, this is it on Radio Eco Shock. Despite everything we know about the coming climate shift, in 2017, carbon emissions to the atmosphere continued to increase. And despite the IPCC and the Paris Accord, we build big loopholes into the system. In fact, we humans are experts at lying to ourselves about climate reality. Here's yet another example. Of course, wood burning is, you know, when you generate electricity with it, that's green energy, right? We just return carbon captured by the trees to the atmosphere. And we've all been told that, except maybe it isn't true, and that little myth alone could help tip us over the edge out of control, along with everything else. Here to explain is Dr. Mary S. Booth. She is an ecological scientist and director of the Partnership for Policy Integrity in New England from Pelham, Massachusetts. Mary Booth, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you've just returned from Bonn. What were you doing there?
I was working with a group of international nonprofits on trying to get the negotiators who are working out the rules for the Paris Agreement to appreciate the importance of forests for climate mitigation. Basically, we need to be growing a lot more trees and, you know, stopping finding ways of destroying our forests, because forests are really important for tying up atmospheric carbon.
Well, one commercial reason for cutting down forests beyond lumber or paper making is to burn the wood to make electricity. We've been told that that's much safer for the climate than fossil fuels. Is that a myth?
It's absolutely a myth. Burning wood emits more CO2 at the stack per megawatt hour than burning even coal. And the idea that you can just regrow forests and somehow sequester all that same carbon that you emitted ignores the fact that this is a massive infusion of carbon into the atmosphere just when we need to be reducing emissions. And of course, growing trees takes a long time, but burning them is very quick.
In your video that you released with your paper, and the video was very helpful, there was a report to the European Parliament stating that emissions from wood and fuel plants, quote, shall be taken to be zero for solid and gaseous biomass. Where does that assumption come from, Mary?
The European Union carbon trading program, which treats emissions as zero, appears to assume that the biomass that's burned in power plants is wastes and residues, things like branches of trees that are left over after saw timber harvesting, or maybe mill residues like a pile of sawdust that's created at a mill when they're making boards. In fact, that's not the case, but even if it were the case, the assumption being that since these things would decompose and emit CO2 anyway, burning them for energy doesn't represent a net addition of carbon to the atmosphere. If it turns out, which is actually the case, that we're burning a lot more than those things, that we're actually cutting down forests for energy, then the carbon impact is actually much greater.
So when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change or other climate modelers do a projection of the future and say, well, we'll stay below 2 degrees by 2100, do they take what you just said into account?
Most of the carbon models, like the climate models that look at pathways to staying below 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees centigrade temperature rise, actually treat burning wood and other biomass as having zero emissions. So this policy idea has been incorporated into most of these models as a physical reality, which, in fact, it's not. As I said before, burning wood emits a lot of carbon. So, you know, you're burning it faster than you're taking it back up. It's going to increase carbon concentrations. So it's really a problem that these models don't take that into account. And there's various reasons why they don't take it into account, but the bottom line is that because of the treatment of bioenergy as carbon neutral in these models, they have baked in assumptions that a lot of the future energy of the world is going to come from burning biomass. And if that actually comes to pass, we'll see a net increase in emissions instead of a decrease.
I can kind of back up something that you said, because I live in a Canadian town with a lumber mill, and right beside it is another big operation chipping wood into sawdust for making paper. And the paper industry always claims that the wood being chewed up is just waste from the sawmills, but we know better. Everyone who lives here can see acres and acres of whole trees laid out there like a little ocean of trees right there at the chipping company being turned into sawdust. Is the same thing happening in the U.S. wood pellet industry?
Absolutely. The U.S. wood pellet industry has been growing explosively to serve the growing demand, particularly in the United Kingdom, believe it or not, which is the biggest consumer of wood pellets in the world, but in the EU as well, and then also increasingly in Asia, Korea and Japan, for instance. The projections are that the wood pellet exports will grow dramatically. So both from the southeastern United States, which is a big wood basket in the world, and also from Canada, trees are being cut down, turned into wood pellets, dried, because it's a much higher quality fuel when you dry the moisture out of it, and then shipped across the ocean to be burned in power plants, where it is officially treated as having zero emissions.
Do we know how much difference it makes if we burn whole trees instead of real waste from other processes?
It approximately doubles the net carbon impact, but it a lot depends. There's a lot of assumptions baked into that. But basically, the problem with cutting down and burning a tree or turning a whole tree into pellets and then burning those is that not only are you liquidating the carbon that's standing in the tree, but you're also foregoing that future carbon that the tree would have taken out of the air and turned into biomass. Trees are growing. As they grow, they convert atmospheric carbon dioxide into terrestrial carbon, that is wood. And so when you cut down a tree, you're foregoing that future sequestration.
If things go according to the projections, do you think that the pellet industry could become big enough to be itself an engine of deforestation?
Oh, I believe it already is an engine of deforestation in the southeast United States. The pellet industry likes to claim that they're only using low-grade wood that is not good for any other purpose, but sometimes it is the existence of a market for low-grade wood that makes it profitable to cut acres that wouldn't otherwise be cut. So we're seeing many, many huge clear cuts in the southeastern United States where the majority of the wood is being taken off to make pellets. And this is not only in pine plantations that were planted years ago for the pulp and paper industry, but also in native hardwood forests. Some of the most carbon-rich and biodiverse forests in the United States are being cut down to turn into pellets. Huge trees that are over 100 years old are being cut down and basically pulped up and pelletized.
Now, of course, that's going to have an impact on the species who lived there previously, the whole ecology, and possibly even the hydrology of the southeastern United States. There's a lot of impacts we're talking about.
Yeah, the impacts are really astounding. Of course, these beautiful hardwood forests are home to many birds and animals, and all of that habitat is obliterated. And then many of these forests are, you know, located in low-lying wetland areas along the banks of rivers. And when they're cut down, you know, forests transpire a lot of moisture into the air. And so that helps control soil moisture and flooding. And when those forests are gone, we see more flooding, more dramatic runoff episodes, erosion. The rivers are choked with silt. Then it hurts the aquatic life as well. There's huge knock-on effects from clear-cutting these forests.
Has the biomass scheme already spread to the hot spots like Indonesia, Equatorial Africa, or the Amazon?
It's starting to. It depends. Burning wood pellets, it's a fairly expensive fuel. And so the places where we're seeing the wood pellet imports are places that have subsidy programs that pay for renewable energy, that give renewable energy credits to, say, a coal plant that is converting over to burning wood. So countries that don't have that tend to not see as much bioenergy being proposed. But it is starting to occur. I mean, for instance, a new colleague I met just recently from Ivory Coast was describing to me several biomass plants that are proposed there that are claiming they're going to be burning waste materials. But we know what happens when there's not enough waste materials from different agricultural efforts and that kind of thing. They turn to burning forest wood. Actually, I was surprised to learn that Ivory Coast had plans to build quite a few bioenergy plants. You know, this is seen as a way of becoming more independent from fossil fuels. But of course, it's a totally false solution, because if you're cutting down forests and burning them in the name of reducing carbon emissions, you're not going to accomplish anything. You're just going to make the problem worse.
And I'm afraid that some environmentalists and green groups are possibly supporting this, saying, well, it's better than coal or better than nuclear.
I think there's been a good amount of education and outreach that's been done in recent years. So more and more groups are realizing that this is a false solution and are collaborating with us and with others to try and oppose this. But you're right, there are still some green groups that are supporting this. And there's a particularly a lot of confusion around, you know, what we've been talking about so far is burning wood to generate electricity. Some people are still advocating pretty strongly for using wood for thermal energy, like a wood pellet industry here in New England, to replace oil. You know, we're quite dependent on heating oil here. And so there's the idea that we can replace our dependence on heating oil with burning wood pellets in stoves in people's homes. And, of course, anything like that where it's scaled up, if you're increasing forest cutting to make those pellets, it's a false solution.
And another factor that you mentioned in your paper about making wood pellets appear to be carbon neutral is replanting and forest growth elsewhere. But I have to say again, here in British Columbia, we cut down vast forests every year, and replanting is not always successful. The climate is changing, and related to that, forests are burning down pretty fast. So some forests are converting to grasslands. We can see it. How do replanting failures relate to your study?
Well, absolutely, replanting failures are a problem. But, you know, beyond that, the biomass industry is still making this crazy argument that bioenergy should be treated as instantaneously carbon neutral, because even though we're cutting and burning trees over here, there are still trees somewhere over there that are still growing and taking carbon out of the air, as if those trees over there can somehow compensate for the additional emissions that they've just caused. This is a totally false argument. It's amazing that policymakers still fall for this. But, you know, even if you look at carbon accounting the right way, which is that we have to wait, you know, if we cut down a tree now, we have to wait for trees in that same spot to grow back to achieve true carbon neutrality, you know, that takes decades, if not more than a century. And meanwhile, you know, as you pointed out, there's very little certainty that it'll actually happen.
Well, plus, when you head out to the woods with a gas-powered chainsaw and then you use all kinds of skidders and heavy equipment to make the logging roads, you put them on trucks, you get them over to a plant. We don't know what that pellet plant works on. And after that, then, as you say, they dry it. Then they're going to ship it probably by truck or rail. That goes into boats. It goes over to Great Britain and gets burned. And then the ash has to be – there's carbon all over the place in that chain.
Absolutely. The fossil fuel emissions that are embedded in pellets are quite high, 15 to 20 to 25% more carbon on top of the carbon inherent in the pellets itself is expended in as fossil fuels, as you pointed out, in, you know, harvesting the trees and then chipping and then pulverizing, pushing it through a dye to make the pellet, and then drying. And then, of course, transport across the ocean. They do burn a lot of wood at the plants to dry the pellets, and that is another big source of carbon emissions that's just not counted. It's not considered as an emission, but, of course, it is an emission. So it's quite carbon intensive. And even in the U.S., where we don't have electricity plants that are burning pellets because, in general, our subsidies aren't high enough to support that, but we do have many plants in the U.S. that burn green wood chips. And I've seen estimates from industry analysts that it's about 2.2 gallons of diesel per ton of wood chips to just harvest them and get them to the plant. So that's not a small amount. And just for comparison, like a 50-megawatt power plant burns about a ton of wood chips per minute, a little more than a ton per minute when it's operating properly.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith with my guest, ecologist Mary Booth from the Partnership for Policy Integrity in Pelham, Massachusetts. We're talking about a dangerous myth of using wood as a mass energy source, and it isn't safe for the climate. Mary, I watched the introductory video you released with the new paper, and frankly, you lost me at the point of replacing an old model to calculate the impact of burning wood for power versus a new model called NEI. For the rest of us, could you take a stab at explaining why we need a new model and what the new model does?
Basically, we need to stop treating burning biomass as having zero emissions. For instance, for a carbon trading program where a power plant has to pay for each ton of carbon that they emit if they're burning fossil fuels, carbon trading programs tend to treat biomass emissions as zero, so power plants don't have to pay for those. We need a way to weight those emissions for how much money should a power plant pay to emit a ton of biomass carbon, given that if that biomass is truly sourced from wastes and residues and genuinely would have emitted carbon anyway from decomposition. You want to know what the net emission is from burning it now rather than letting it decompose. And that's the weighting that you would assign that would say how much they should pay for that ton of carbon. So basically, this just says that burning emits carbon quickly. Decomposing material in the field, if it were left in the field, which is the alternative fate, emits carbon slowly. The difference between those two numbers is the additional carbon that's been emitted by burning the biomass as fuel instead of leaving it to decompose. And it's that additional carbon, that net emission, that needs to be counted and paid for. And all the NEI does is just express as a percentage of stack emissions what the net emissions are that should be valued.
I think I got that. That's great. You also say, quote, climate models, renewable energy policies, and carbon trading programs in the U.S. and EU erroneously treat biomass sourced from residues as carbon neutral, end quote. How big is that error, and what does it say about the possibility of our goal to stay below 2 degrees C by the year 2100?
Well, it's hard to say how big the error is because we don't actually know how much of the residues and the biomass that's being burned is genuinely residues and how much of those residues are things that would have been burned anyway, in which case there's no net emissions versus something that would have decomposed. But basically, many of these models for renewable energy anticipate that there will be about 100 exajoules of bioenergy from wastes and residues. And if you burned 100 exajoules of biomass, it would represent about 9 billion tons of carbon per year. So that's 9 billion tons that would be emitted and not counted, just treated as zero by these models. And that's not insignificant, given that we're supposed to be getting to net zero emissions in the next couple of decades. So how much of that would need to be weighted and counted would really depend on what kinds of fuels were being burned. But the overall magnitude of the stack emissions of 9 billion tons is really quite important and large number that needs to be paid attention to.
Is a billion tons and a gigaton the same thing?
Yes.
Okay, so I did a little calculation trying to figure this out for myself, like how big is 9 gigatons of CO2 that would happen if the doubling of or more of bioenergy happens. And it works out that that's equal to 1/4 of the total emissions from fossil fuels in 2017. So that is really significant. That could change the climate.
Yeah. Well, it would mean, you know, importantly, that we'd be pouring all these resources and energy and physical resources into building biomass power facilities that serve as carbon pumps that convert terrestrial carbon that's embedded in trees into atmospheric carbon, and making these huge infrastructure investments in the name of something that is a false solution, that's actually increasing emissions instead of decreasing them. We, at this point, we are almost out of time And we need to be making really big investments into true zero emissions technologies. And of course, there's carbon embedded in the making of a wind turbine or a solar panel as well. And so there's nothing that has no carbon impact, but these kinds of technologies pay off their carbon debt a lot faster than bioenergy, which not only has the expensive carbon-intensive infrastructure of the biomass power plant, but is burning a fuel that emits carbon continuously.
What needs to be done to close this serious loophole in international climate agreements and renewable energy funding?
There's several different things that need to happen to close the loophole. There's some rather arcane but important conventions of how carbon is counted by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and how countries report their biomass emissions. There's some changes that need to happen there. But most important is that we need an infusion of common sense from policymakers. It's just beggars the imagination that people think that we can burn forests and not have an impact on the climate. And, you know, the biomass industry has been extraordinarily effective in convincing policymakers that this is a solution for mitigating climate change. And I think your average fourth grader could tell you that burning forests to mitigate climate change is not a good idea. So this really needs common sense, and it needs people to stand up and say to policymakers that, you know, when we're promoting renewable energy, when we're giving subsidies for renewable energy, we don't want our public money spent on tree-burning power plants. We do want it spent on efficiency, megawatts, of course, first, and then new infrastructure that doesn't emit carbon.
So there you are in New England. Mary, what got you seriously investigating wood energy as a suspect source in this new energy future?
I came back to New England in 2007 after being away for a number of years and first started working on a water withdrawal permit for a biomass power plant that was proposed here in Massachusetts. And they wanted to take over 800,000 gallons a day out of the wild and scenic Westfield River for cooling for this biomass, this 50-megawatt biomass power plant. And I worked with some other people to help oppose that permit and get it rewritten because it was seriously flawed. And in the course of that, I came to understand that the state of Massachusetts was promoting biomass power as a zero-emissions technology. And, of course, that just I'd never heard of anything so ridiculous. And so I started working on it here in Massachusetts and then nationally and now internationally. 10 years later, here I am still working on it, and I kind of find it hard to believe that we haven't successfully killed this idea yet, that we can burn forests and call it carbon neutral.
Mary, what are you working on now?
I am working on trying to find ways to close these loopholes in international policy that allow bioenergy to be treated as carbon neutral, both in the IPCC and the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the UNFCCC, where the negotiations about Paris Agreement implementation are happening.
Could you briefly tell us what is Partnership for Policy Integrity?
We're a small nonprofit. We work on mostly on two issues, which is obviously bioenergy, and then we also have a small oil and gas program that working on fracking impacts and toxicity of fracking chemicals. That's headed up by our senior attorney, Dusty Horwitt. And we're totally foundation-funded. People sometimes wonder if we get funding from the fossil fuel industry. We don't. And it would be funny if we did, because it's actually the fossil fuel industry that is promoting biomass burning in a lot of cases. So that's our story. We're very targeted on these two non-solutions to climate change.
Why would the fossil fuel industry promote biomass burning?
Because coal plants, if they can switch to burning wood, can be exempted from carbon trading programs. This is what happened in the UK. The massive Drax plant in Yorkshire, which was providing, it's a 3-gigawatt plant, and it was providing up to 7% of the UK's power. They've converted half the plant to burn wood. So they're importing millions of tons of pellets from mostly from the U.S. and some from Canada and then some from other places as well. And they have been exempted. Not only are they getting close to 2 million pounds a day in subsidies from the U.K. government, courtesy of U.K. ratepayers, but they are also exempted from purchasing allowances under the EU trading system for the CO2 that they emit when they burn biomass.
Boy, the circle is coming full turn, because I remember reading in history how when the Industrial Revolution started and in the early days of metalmaking in Europe and in Britain in particular, there was just this wide area of southern Britain that was deforested due to the need for wood. And now it's happening again, except they're drawing it from overseas and from much further away.
Yeah, we really haven't stopped being a colony for them. We're just providing energy now. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, deforestation to provide heat and power is nothing new. And, you know, what people don't appreciate or understand much is that fossil fuels are, I mean, I'm no fan of fossil fuels, but they are amazing in the sense that there's a tremendous amount of energy packed into a relatively small amount of matter. And attempting to replace fossil fuels with wood means massive, massive forest harvesting to replace even a relatively small amount of fossil fuels.
We've been talking about the myth of green energy from wood. Our guest is Dr. Mary S. Booth from the Partnership for Policy Integrity in Pelham, Massachusetts. Her paper, Not Carbon Neutral, Assessing the Net Emissions Impact of Residues Burned for Bioenergy, was published February 21st, 2018, in the journal Environmental Research Letters. You can access the full text for free. I'll put a link in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Mary, thank you so much for helping us understand this.
Thank you for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
While I can't promise you dirt on presidents and porn stars, you will get the real bomb in our next interview. Nobody could make up the twists and turns in the high-stakes game of atomic weapons. Haven't you heard? The nuclear arms race is back. And there's big money to be made, as long as nothing blows up in our faces. We are going to talk about a suicide cult run by the American government. In May, the Trump administration announced they would abandon a multi-billion dollar nuclear construction project in South Carolina. That's the good news. It was intended to add deadly plutonium to nuclear reactor fuel. It was a terrible idea. Nobody wanted that product. But we can't lose the jobs or the boondoggle billions, so here's an even crazier idea. Let's build more triggers for nuclear bombs we can't use. We'll just add them to thousands and thousands of other plutonium triggers sitting in a warehouse somewhere outside Amarillo, Texas. It's all painfully crazy, but we have to talk about it because that's the plan. In New Mexico, the Los Alamos National Laboratory tried to build the same plutonium pits. That operation has been shut down for a few years due to wildly unsafe working conditions with plutonium. All that is carefully witnessed by a small but powerful environmental nonprofit called NukeWatch. Jay Coghlan is the executive director of Nuclear Watch New Mexico. Jay, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me.
I hate talking about this stuff. Many people tune out or don't download when we cover anything nuclear, especially nuclear weapons. It's just too crazy to hear about, I guess. Jay, do you encounter that eye-rolling resistance?
I do some. You know, kind of my typical response, I like to invoke a cliche, and it's, you know, you may not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you. And for the sake of this show, I would translate it into, you may not want to talk about nuclear weapons, but nuclear weapons could ruin your whole day. They're interested in you.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's start with the basics in case somebody doesn't know. What is plutonium, and is it found in nature?
Oddly enough, yes, it is found in nature, but it was found after it was made man-made in a reactor. And the only instance I know of is in the Congo in Africa, where there was an extremely unusually rich bed of uranium ore. And in effect, it acted as a natural reactor producing plutonium from the uranium. Now, that's just kind of a footnote. It's really all about the man-made produced plutonium in reactors. And there's various isotopes of plutonium, but the isotope of choice for nuclear weapons is plutonium-239 with a half-life of 24,000 years. That's good in the sense that plutonium pits last a long time. It's bad in the sense that the waste, the excess plutonium, remains dangerous for more than 100,000 years.
And the government wants to double their production facilities to make something called plutonium pits. What are those?
Well, first of all, it's quadruple production from roughly 20 to, now they call it at least 80 per year. But pits, you know, just an amusing side note, but I once went to Russia and had a fact sheet translated. And I looked up and saw that my Russian audience was very puzzled, and it turned out that the word pit had been inadvertently translated as like a hole in the ground or a shaft. So that's not what it is. It's like the pit of a peach, the core. And in this case, it's a roughly softball-sized sphere of plutonium that's actually hollow, and into the hollowness, into the hollow at the a nanosecond before detonation, a radioactive gaseous isotope of hydrogen is injected, that being tritium. So they basically explode together. The plutonium fissions, in turn inducing fusion with the tritium, which turns around and boosts, that's the word that's used, boosts the remaining plutonium. And that's the way that all modern plutonium pits, also called triggers for nuclear weapons. That's, you know, the essence of their design. They're surrounded by high explosives that symmetrically implode the pit so that it can reach a critical mass, which attains temperatures and pressures like that of the sun. But then that results in the nuclear detonation almost instantaneously.
I can't imagine anything more dangerous.
It's certainly up there in the very most dangerous. And I'd have to interject, especially when, perhaps especially given that we have what I would lightly say are some rash, impulsive world leaders.
Well, sure. What's the point of having nuclear weapons if you can't use them on somebody? And what we're talking about here is incinerating possibly entire megacities with bombs. That's the purpose of this plan. Let's get back to the original purpose of the South Carolina MOX, as they call it, nuclear fuel plant. Where is it, and why is that being abandoned?
The MOX plant, that's MOX is mixed oxide, which, you know, doesn't mean that much for the listeners. But as you described it, it was to fabricate nuclear reactor rods with plutonium in it so that it would so-called burn the plutonium as a non-proliferation measure to help get rid of military stocks of plutonium. And just to give this context, both the U.S. and Russia agreed to get rid of 34 tons of plutonium each, which, you know, could make tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. So on the surface, the MOX program sounds good. In reality, rather than being a non-proliferation program, it was arguably a proliferation program, the opposite of what was claimed, in the sense that it was introducing plutonium into the global market. So that's number one. Number two is just the MOX fuel fabrication facility, that's what it's called, in Aiken, South Carolina, which is almost on the border of Georgia, just across from the Savannah River. It just became such a boondoggle. The costs escalated. The schedule was way overextended. So it just became this huge money sink. So the U.S. Department of Energy finally decided to pull the plug on it, although it's stopping the project is facing fierce resistance from the South Carolina congressional delegation and particularly Senator Lindsey Graham, who is a powerful senator and sits on the Armed Services Committee. But in short, that's the status of the MOX plant at the Savannah River site in South Carolina. And then what we're talking mostly about now is the fact that the Department of Energy now plans to turn that plant into a pit production facility.
And there's a government agency involved here that I hadn't heard about, and I'm into nuclear things. What is the National Nuclear Security Administration?
It is a semi-autonomous agency that runs all the nuclear weapons programs within the Department of Energy. And it came in existence in the year 2000, principally because of my then and now deceased Senator Pete Domenici, who the weapons labs called St. Pete for the money, for the buckets of money that he would arrange for him. But I want to note a very ironic piece, is that some of your listeners may be familiar with the name Wen-Ho Lee, and that was this big espionage case in the late 1990s, and a Chinese-American who, you know, some argue he was singled out because of his ethnicity. But in short, he actually did solitary time while waiting for his trial. To make a long story short, the government's case fell apart against him. The federal judge made a public apology to Wen-Ho Lee. But the point I'm making is, and this is the irony, is it's the Wen-Ho Lee case that propelled the creation of this semi-autonomous nuclear weapons agency within the Department of Energy. And the rationale was to fix various security problems that were going on, including you know, the alleged Wen-Ho Lee affair. The irony is, after NNSA was created, that's when some very serious and real security problems occurred, and they occurred mostly at Los Alamos Lab.
I heard they got practically everything Los Alamos had and it went straight to China.
I wouldn't be able to verify that.
All right, that's just a rumor. So meanwhile, we're talking about putting more plutonium handling facilities into South Carolina, and the South Carolina, aren't they suing the federal government to get plutonium out of that Savannah River nuclear weapons site?
That is correct. The federal government, and specifically the Department of Energy, agreed that there would be only so much plutonium at the Savannah River site, and not only agreed to so much, but that it had to decrease over time. And the exit strategy for that plutonium was the MOX program that we were just talking about, but now the MOX program is canceled. Now, DOE is starting to formulate a plan to, you know, they call it dilute and dispose, where they will dilute the plutonium and send them to the only hole in the ground that exists for radioactive waste in the United States, which is the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant in southern New Mexico. But, you know, that's still years off. So as you've said, the state of South Carolina is suing the Department of Energy over its failure to begin to dispose of plutonium and getting it out of South Carolina. So it's quite a contentious issue in South Carolina. And here I speculate that this recent decision by the Department of Energy to begin producing plutonium pits at the Savannah River site, which would be a completely new mission there. They're starting from scratch. But in part, that could be a political maneuver to help improve DOE's relationship with the state of South Carolina. And again, that's just speculation on my part.
But I thought the Los Alamos National Laboratory, near you, or in your state at least, had plutonium handling labs. Why isn't the plutonium pit production just performed there?
Now, first of all, I'm in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I'm looking out my living room right now, 20 miles away, and I can see Los Alamos Lab.
Okay.
But as you noted, you know, first of all, Los Alamos is the birthplace of plutonium pit production. And, you know, giving credit where credit's due, that is the amazing technical feat that Los Alamos under J.R. Oppenheimer achieved during the World War II years. And it was a plutonium pit that they blew up at the Trinity test on July 16, 1945. Then they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima August 6, 1945. Now, that was a uranium bomb, which is a much simpler design. So they didn't even bother testing it, and the first test was, in fact, destroying Hiroshima. Now, Nagasaki, that was a plutonium bomb. And this illustrates how a plutonium pit is a weapon unto itself. Now, it's not a nuclear weapon, it's an atomic weapon. And when we say refer to plutonium pits being triggers nowadays, it's also sometimes called primaries. So it is the initial step, which in turn induces fusion in the second stage. And the way I like to put it, that's what puts the H in H-bomb. But again, as you noted, Los Alamos has existing plutonium pit production facilities, and they were producing a limited number of plutonium pits up until 2011. And then they just started experiencing this non-ending series of near misses, of potential nuclear criticality incidences. And that's where you have too much special nuclear material together in one place at one time, and that can have a spontaneous neutron flux, which can literally fry people. So it was this ongoing series of problems. They suspended major plutonium operations at Los Alamos for more than 3 years. And, you know, I suspect that DOE just got fed up with it. And also I'm told that the Pentagon, out of an abundance of caution, is insisting on two different locations for pit production, you know, as you might call it, a fail-safe measure. But I hasten to point out to your listeners that plutonium pit production, first of all, we have already, the U.S. has, up to 20,000 plutonium pits already sitting down at the Pantex plant outside of Amarillo, Texas. So that's for starters. And future production is not to maintain the safety and reliability of the existing nuclear weapons stockpile. Instead, it is for future new designs. And that's a fact.
Okay, I'm going to get right back to that.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@eagleshock.org. That's radio@eagleshock.org.
This is Alex Smith, and you are listening to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Jay Coghlan, the executive director of Nuclear Watch New Mexico. We're talking about the madness of making even more plutonium triggers or weapons for America. And you just mentioned the new design nuclear weapons that have been proposed, and I wonder, is that to compete with the new nuclear weapons and delivery systems announced by the Russians this year? Can that be used, Jay, as a justification for needing new nuclear weapons?
Well, these new nuclear weapons, the American ones, were already proposed before all the publicity about the new Russian weapons. But that's just kind of a detail. The main point I would like to stress, since you brought this up, is, and I really want your listeners to know this, The U.S. and Russia are very much back into a nuclear arms race, which just seems absurd. I mean, you know, the Cold War ended. You pick a year. It's hard to, you know, well, the Berlin Wall fell in 1989 and the Soviet Union dissolved in 1992. So here we are more than 25 years later, and we're back in an arms race with Russia. And I just view this as so unnecessary. And I'm sad to report that the older I get, the more cynical I'm getting. And the reason I say that is over the years, my belief grows stronger that at least in the United States, a lot of this is just plain driven by contractor greed, that the profit motive is a very strong driver in all of this. And in fact, we have three nuclear weapons labs here in the U.S. in my beloved state of New Mexico, otherwise known as the land of enchantment, is privileged, I say that somewhat sarcastically, to have two of the three American nuclear weapons labs. But a little known fact is that the directors of all three labs wear two hats. And the first is as lab director. And believe me, they have a whole lot of power because they have to stand in front of Congress every year and testify that the stockpile is safe and reliable. And all hell would break loose if they said the stockpile wasn't. But the second hat that they wear is as presidents of the executive committees of for-profit limited liability corporations that run the labs. So I am definitely asserting that the profit motive drives things.
And it's not just competition with the Russians. You know, I was reading an article by Patrick Malone at the Center for Public Integrity, and he said a fellow named Philip Kalbos, one of the NNSA's principal assistant deputy administrator for defense, and Kalbos told the panel, quote, "It's not lost on anyone that there are nations out there that produce more pits than we do, including the North Koreans. And that's one of the reasons we need to get moving in terms of our capability. So, Jay, when it comes to nuclear weapons, America needs to keep up with North Korea?"
You know, that is a political... I regard that as political propaganda. Now, that said, we have briefly touched upon all of the problems that Los Alamos has had. But I believe, for one thing, that the U.S. simply has quite high and stringent standards when it comes to actually qualifying a plutonium pit for the stockpile. And in fact, when they send a pit after producing it to the stockpile, after it goes through the many, many tests, and by that I don't mean a full-scale nuclear test, but after it goes through the whole process, they call it a diamond-stamped pit. So the American process is extremely rigorous. And I'm going to make clear that the details are classified, so I'm not going to pretend to be a know-it-all here. And this is somewhat informed speculation, I'll put it this way. But again, the American standards are going to be far higher than Russian standards, far higher than North Korean standards. And if the U.S. had to produce a plutonium pit, by God, they could do it tomorrow. I'm quite confident of that. But this has definitely become a big propaganda piece among the U.S. nuclear weaponeers and boosters. You know, they're saying, oh my God, out of the nine nuclear weapons powers, only the U.S. cannot produce a plutonium pit. I don't think that really withstands deeper scrutiny.
Well, we were talking about safety, and a whole lot of plutonium pits were made in Colorado at the now-closed Rocky Flats site, and safety there was so bad the FBI raided Rocky Flats in 1989, and you wonder what it takes for the FBI to raid a nuclear weapons production outfit. And I spent last night reading through some horror stories from Los Alamos Lab, and it kind of kept me awake past 2 in the morning just thinking about that. I'm not terribly well informed on this. So is there a possibility for an actual nuclear explosion if there was an accident at one of these plutonium factories?
No, not a nuclear explosion. But you could have a neutron flux, as I've already mentioned, which can fry people. But that's not the same thing as an explosion. You could have dispersal of plutonium, which is especially dangerous if it's in powdered form and is respirable, that is, in a form where it's in the air and you can breathe it. And plutonium is known to be a high risk factor for lung cancers. But an actual explosion, no. There is a possible exception with highly enriched uranium, different from plutonium. And in theory, now this is only in theory, but you could hold, and you know, again, the numbers are going to be classified, but you could hold, say, 15 pounds, if you're suicidal, 15 pounds of highly enriched uranium in one hand and 15 pounds in the other, and then clap your hands and kiss your butt goodbye. But, you know, again, I'm not Chicken Little here. The risks of an actual nuclear explosion in one of these manufacturing facilities, no. But that's not to undermine the fact that there are high risks otherwise.
Well, there's huge risks, I think, to the people who work there and the people in the surrounding areas. But also, the major risk is that somebody, perhaps even President Trump, will decide they should use a nuclear weapon and incinerate millions of people. So have you heard of any citizen resistance in South Carolina to the announced plan to make plutonium pits?
That area is full of boosters. Now, that said, I have a close colleague in South Carolina, and he and I are actively talking about how to catalyze greater public resistance to moving pit production there. And there's wild claims being made by local politicians in both South Carolina and New Mexico about the jobs that will be produced. And I've asked for solid data on job creation, and just from the Department of Energy and even my own congressional delegation. And so far, I'm not able to get it. But you have to understand that on the local level, the rationale for these programs is threefold. Jobs, jobs, jobs. Never mind the fact that military jobs or military funding has the lowest economic multiplying benefit of all. You know, the Trump administration is, for example, is radically cutting federal funding for research into renewable energies, and that is what would really be a job producer, and is also holding funding for cleanup flat, which again would be a real job producer, and instead, in part, that pays for ever-increasing budgets for nuclear weapons programs. And you mentioned the National Nuclear Security Administration. Its budget for nuclear weapons programs is taking a 19% jump from 2018 to 2019. So weapons programs are very much on the rise, and local politicians use their jobs as the rationale for doing that. I find that pretty distasteful. These are, you know, weapons of more than just mass destruction. They can be weapons of global destruction. And to me, it's just distasteful to explain them away for the sake of jobs, and a limited number of jobs at that.
Talk to us about your own organization, Nuclear Watch, and your fight against plutonium pits in New Mexico.
Oh, we're a small outfit. As some people have put it, I like this phrase, we punch above our weight because we are small. I've been in this field of work for just short of 30 years. And, you know, my day job is that of being an activist. And part of my job as an activist is to encourage others to be active. And I do want to say, myself personally and Nuke Watch, you know, we certainly have drawn blood. I'm not saying we can kill the beast, but we certainly have drawn blood with the labs, successful litigation, you know, that kind of thing. But I want to use this as encouragement to your listeners that if you get up, get off of the couch, get active, you know, in whatever issue captures you, I'm personally amazed at the success I've had. And I hope I don't sound immodest. That's not my point. My point is not to boast. My point is to encourage others to be active on whatever issue really gets you. And if you begin to be active and you stick with it, you can, and you know, it takes time, of course. It takes time. But I think, like me, you could end up being amazed that, you know, I'm going to call myself, you know, an average citizen or whatever. You know, I don't have a PhD or anything, but I'm simply amazed by the success I've had. And, dear listener, you can do it too.
We've been talking with Jay Coghlan, the executive director of Nuclear Watch New Mexico. Find them at nukewatch.org. I'll put more links to this story in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Jay, thank you for fighting to shine the light in such dark places, and thank you for talking with us.
You're most welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
On the Nuclear Watch New Mexico website, I found these words from the famous American general Omar Bradley. Ours is a world of nuclear giants and ethical infants. Both interviews this week remind us of another old saying, the road to hell is wide and paved with good intentions. For me and for our guests, the only way forward is to seek the truth. When your truth finds you, it will drive you to share it far and wide, then act on it. That is Radio EcoShock for me, and that is all I have for you this week. I'm Alex Smith. On behalf of the kindred souls in over 100 countries who listen weekly via radio, download, or podcast, and with the supportive community who are kind enough to urge me on, thank you for listening and caring about our world.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
The Palestinians definitely have a right to health care. That's being denied through this essentially enforced embargo on medical supplies and medical personnel.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. On Tuesday, May 15th, Gaza's health ministry reported that 62 Palestinians had been killed and almost 3,200 injured by Israeli forces in the territory since Monday, when Israeli forces opened fire on tens of thousands of Palestinians during the Great March of Return protest. A day of mourning was declared in the West Bank and Gaza on Tuesday as tens of thousands participated in funeral processions and offered condolences to grieving families in Gaza. As of Tuesday, more than 100 Palestinians, including 12 children, two journalists, and a paramedic, had been killed during the Great March of Return protests held near Gaza's eastern boundary since March 30th. More than 12,600 Palestinians have been injured during the 7 weeks of protests, most of them requiring hospitalization. One soldier has been reported injured, the only Israeli casualty during the protests. The paramedic who was among those killed on Monday, Musa Jaber Abu Kasnain, had, about an hour before he was shot in the chest by an Israeli sniper, treated a Palestinian-Canadian doctor who was shot in the leg and knee. That doctor is Tarek Loubani, an emergency physician who lives in Ontario and is an associate professor at the University of Western Ontario's Medical School. Loubani has continued his work with Gaza-based physicians and designers to mitigate the overwhelming lack of basic medical supplies and electricity needed to operate hospitals and treat patients as Israel and Egypt continue the 11-year-old blockade against Gaza. He was in Gaza to join medical teams and test tourniquets that he helped design using open-source technology and 3D printers. We're now joined by Tarek Loubani from Gaza. And full disclosure, as your friend, Tarek, I'm so glad you're okay and so glad you're able to join us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you so much, Nora, for having me.
So before we talk about what happened when you were shot, let's talk about why you were there. We've known for a long time that Israel has used Gaza as a laboratory, a testing ground to try out new lethal weapons on a captive human population. These weapons, as we know, are then sold to other militaries and police forces around the world with the bonus of being battle-proven or field-tested. On the other side of that, part of your work in Gaza over the last few weeks has been to field test basic medical supplies. You've been working with physicians and makers in Gaza for years, trying to develop stethoscopes and tourniquets and other instruments that can be made using 3D printers and then immediately used to treat patients in the field or in the operating room or in triage in the ER because of the shocking shortages of basic supplies in Gaza. Tell us about your work with this project and the current need to create tourniquets that medics can use in Gaza. What brought you to this project and to Gaza, and how were these supplies being tested in the field?
It's been quite a while that we've been of the position that we need to make our own medical devices. We can't trust the Israelis to allow medical devices in, despite the fact that they shouldn't be blocked by the blockade. We can't trust the Egyptians to bring medical devices in, despite the fact that they say that they're always happy to, and we simply are not able to buy them within the local market. Other companies just don't have the know-how and the talent to make high-quality devices. There are some very cheap, very poor-quality generics around. As such, we started with a very small mechanical project, a stethoscope, very iconic of doctors. We proved it was just as good as a $300 stethoscope, except for the fact that it costs only $2 for us to produce. And we started to distribute it to physicians in Canada and in Gaza. We flipped the model of medical development. Usually, these sorts of things are tested in the third world and sold in the first world. What we did was we tested in the first world to make sure that the devices were good and then brought it into the third world, into the Gaza Strip, where we started to distribute it and train people on how to use these stethoscopes. While we were increasing the abilities of the people in Gaza to use this particular technology, there were a few of us within a project that we call GLIA who are doing this. It caught the attention of some people in the disaster committee who had finally completed a report on the 2014 war that showed that of the something like 2,500 deaths, I don't remember the exact number, so I'm sorry if I'm overstating it, about half of them died because they bled to death, which in medicine is considered unnecessary. You should never bleed to death from your arms or your legs if you're well cared for. And so we decided, well, they decided actually, and came to our team and said, hey, can we make some tourniquets using these 3D printers? The project was well received. It was simple. It was straightforward. It was cheap to implement. The only problem was we ran out of time. We started field testing in February, and very, very quickly in February, I was here at the time, it became obvious people were going to march starting March 30th, and it was going to be huge. As such, we knew that there'd be some armed Israeli suppression of these peaceful protests, and we knew that the tourniquets would be needed. We didn't want to go to production right then, but we had to. We thought that even an incomplete product was going to be better than no product. And I'm happy to report that since we started, it's a two-part program, training people on how to stop bleeding and providing these 3D printed tourniquets. And since we started the program, nobody died because they bled from their arms or legs to death during the protests from March 30th until, unfortunately, May 14th, when quite a few people did die of those injuries. So we knew that the tourniquet worked, even though it had some problems. We went back to the drawing table, fixed these problems. That's why I was there on May the 11th to field test. That's why I was there on May the 14th to also field test and to deploy. I'm a very seasoned war doctor. I've worked in Iraq, Gaza Strip, the West Bank, South Lebanon, Colombia, Venezuela. I know what I'm doing around guns, and I know what I'm doing around people who want to shoot me with their guns. I know where to stand. I know where to be. And on this particular day, on the 14th, basically we just could see very quickly that the Israelis were going to shoot a lot of people. We ran out of our supply of tourniquets very early in the morning. The protests were really officially starting at around 1 or 2. And yet by 10 o'clock in the morning, we'd run out of tourniquets. So I went to resupply. All we had left was 8 of them. So I brought those back, distributed them. There was a lull, no burning tires, no smoke, no tear gas, nobody messing around in front of the border, or the buffer zone, that is. Just a clearly marked medical team well away from everybody else. And unfortunately, that's when I got shot.
Tarek, you were wearing blue-green hospital scrubs, the people you were with. You said you were part of a medical team. You were clearly identifiable as paramedics, as physicians. And how close to the buffer zone were you? And you wrote about this in a post for Medium. Lay out the scene for us. How close geographically were you to the snipers just across the fence? And what happened when you were shot?
There were 3 sniper posts, I think, that I could see on the eastern border of, I guess, the buffer zone. We were set up like a triangle, with the tip of the triangle pointing towards the Israeli soldiers being where the protesters were, and then 25 meters to the west and 25 meters to the north was where the journalists were, and 25 meters to the west and 25 meters to the south of that point in the triangle was where the medics were. There were about, 15 of us at the very beginning. And we huddled there because we knew we would otherwise get in the crossfire. We were so far away that there was no way we were going to get shot accidentally or get caught in any kind of spray crossfire or anything like that. I mean, everybody there has heard more gunshots than any of us can probably imagine. I was the baby in gunshots of the group, and I consider myself seasoned. So, yeah, everybody was quite experienced, and the environs made it such that it was very hard to believe that the sniper didn't know who he was targeting.
What happened? How do you describe what it feels like being shot?
I heard a bang on my right side and then just felt this incredible pain that put me on my back. I was on the ground before I even really finished hearing the bang. I thought, what happened? And I thought, I've been shot. Actually, I think somebody else said, you've been shot. I don't remember. I yelled "F-" as loud as I could. And the medics were right beside me, and they started treating me immediately. My leg was bleeding. And Musa, the paramedic who would later die, Musa Abu Hassanan, he looked at me and he says, oh, Dr. Fadit, do you want me to put a tourniquet on you? And I looked at my leg and I looked at the blood on the ground and I knew I needed one. I knew if I were anywhere else, I'd get one. But I also knew we only had 8, one of which was in my back pocket. I said, no, bandage it, let's go. So they bandaged it, it bled like hell.
And the bullet, can you describe what kind of bullet was used and why you told me yesterday when we were texting, you said you were lucky.
I don't know exactly what kind of bullet, but it was small and it was probably not moving at very high speed. We kind of divide bullets into high velocity and low velocity. And the bullet went basically just behind and down from my knee on the left side. It missed just the bones, and it missed just what's called the neurovascular bundle, the nerves and the veins and the arteries that connect everything. If it hit that bundle, I would have ended up with an above-knee amputation, very, very common in these sorts of gunshot wounds. And then it went to the right knee and just missed my kneecap in front of my kneecap. So from the way I was standing and the trajectory of the bullet, I know exactly where it came from. It came from the northernmost sniper post, most likely.
And the policy of kneecapping is increasingly common, not just in Gaza, but also against Palestinians in the West Bank. Can you talk about what these injuries usually look like and what happens when someone is shot in the knee or in these bundles of nerves?
I can't speak to what exactly the Israelis are thinking when they do this. However, the essence is that we have 60% of all of our traumas that are in the lower limbs, and not 60% of your body is in the lower limbs. In other parts of the world, or when there's kind of random shooting, almost all of the shots are in the thorax, the stomach, the chest. These wounds usually, not usually, but very often can kill people. Kneecapping won't really kill people, but it will maim them. And that's why some organizations have started asking the question, is this an organized Israeli policy with 60% of their shots hitting lower limbs and almost 20% of their shots hitting upper limbs? And a very comparatively small number hitting the thorax, which is actually where you'd expect most of the fire to go.
We're speaking with Dr. Tarek Loubani. He is in the occupied Gaza Strip. Tarek, you were attended to by Musa Abu Hassanin, who was shot and killed by an Israeli sniper just about an hour after you were shot. Can you tell us a little bit about Musa, how you worked together, and the circumstances around his killing by Israeli forces?
Musa was about the same age as me, just a year younger than I was. Had kids. He was a good paramedic. He was a solid rescuer. He was just a stand-up guy. He used to wear these ridiculous goatees. Every time I'd see him, I'd just be like, what are you doing to your face? And when I saw him when I got back to Gaza, he had grown this like little beard. I'm like, okay, fine. Better than those ridiculous goatees. He was a trainer. He knew what he was doing, and he didn't have to be there, but he knew that there was such a shortage that he wanted to be on the scene helping. We had sort of trained together. I'd worked with him before. He was good at his job. He was solid. An hour after I was shot. There was a group of protesters who were pinned down by constant fire just north of where I was shot. And so Musa and six other rescuers followed the same protocol that we had been following all day. They slowly approached the scene with their hands up, clear, high visibility. There was no smoke. There was no tear gas. There were no burning tires. And at some point, he got hit in the chest. It sounds like it was consistent fire, so it doesn't sound like it was a sniper bullet as such. It sounds like it was just somebody spraying their rifle, but who knows. When he went down, all of the paramedics hit the deck, and they were able to get to cover behind a rock, but they weren't able to get him to cover until things calmed down, which took about 20 minutes. They finally recovered him. They finally dragged him off the field, and by then it was too late. He died of a very preventable condition. Had I been there, I could have fixed it with a big pen, although tension pneumothorax.
So sorry. Tariq, let's talk about what it looks like when the media retreats from the perimeter, when physicians in Gaza are dealing with the enormous influx of patients. We're talking more than 12,000 injured in the past 7 weeks. What does recovery look like without regular electricity in the hospitals as a basic fundamental? And how did hospitals and clinics triage this many people coming in with all the constraints?
At a minimum, you recover from wounds using ice. Ice would have helped my recovery tremendously. Where is the ice? And that's true for everybody in the hospitals, too. There just isn't enough electricity to go freeze a bunch of ice for people. There also isn't enough electricity to make sure there's light all the time. And so people who are trying to get to the bathroom, or people who are trying to get out of bed who are just able to ambulate, end up falling and causing more serious complications. I think something close to 15 to 20, I don't remember the exact number of people, died because they couldn't receive timely care like surgeries while they were waiting because things were so flooded. So it's a terrible situation. I mean, we would not be able to tolerate it in Canada. You would not be able to tolerate it in the United States. It should not be tolerated here. The Palestinians definitely have a right to health care that's being denied through this essentially enforced embargo on medical supplies and medical personnel.
Tariq, we've talked on this podcast before, years ago, about the lack of medicines that hospitals in Gaza are dealing with. What medications would you normally be working with in Ontario that aren't available in Gaza, and how do physicians improvise?
Usually, there's a list of about 50% essential medications stocked out, unavailable. However, now, that is almost 100%. There is not enough medications for anything. The only medications I took for my gunshot wound, and your medical listeners will appreciate this, was Tylenol and Advil. And I brought them with me from Canada. They're not even available. When I went looking for a crutch, firstly, you can't buy a pair of crutches because there just aren't enough crutches in the country. And we had to pull favors to get me a crutch. I mean, it's everything. Everything is short because even a well-designed, well-funded, well-run system doesn't have the resources to deal with 2,700 700 wounded, of which I think 1,500 or 1,600 were gunshot wounds in one day. So that's just not something anyone can deal with, let alone a place that is already creaking to its breaking point.
How can you assess the level of rehabilitation that will be needed for this many injured people? And you know, how is rehab even possible under these conditions?
I was sent home within an hour of being seen. I was told, good luck. In Canada, I'd have gotten a surgery. I'd have stayed in hospital. I had gotten lots of different kinds of antibiotics. Here I managed to get some antibiotics. And I'm just going to wait and see if I get infected in a few days. Deal with it then. It's so unacceptable. It's not just unacceptable for me. It's unacceptable for all my patients who are in this situation. I'm frankly luckier than every other patient who's in this situation. I think very few people were as lucky as me to be shot in a place that missed the worst parts of the knee. And so if they have worse injuries and higher rates of infection and aren't able to have surgeries, I mean, these are not doctors sitting at home who know exactly what to do. I am. I really fear for the next stages of trauma. You know, there's stage one is how many people die in minutes to hours. Stage two is how many people die in days to weeks. And stage three after that is how many people die in weeks to months. And usually if you deal well with trauma, they all die in stage one. But here it's pretty clear that there's going to be a lot of mortality and morbidity in the later stages of trauma, which should never happen.
Tarek, are you planning to continue treating patients, even though you're going through your own rehabilitation?
I can't right now. I can't be on the field. It's too rugged. There's bug fire. You got sinisters. You have to run. You have to jump. You have to drag people. You have to pull people. It's rugged. I can't be on the field. If I can get up, if I can just even stand in one spot for long enough, maybe I can be in the emergency. But right now, I'm off. I can't really do much of anything.
Well, finally, tell us how people can learn more about the GLIA project of using open source technology to 3D print supplies that people need in Gaza, and how can people get involved?
Probably the best way to read about it now would be a link through your page, if that's possible, or just doing a web search for open source tourniquet. Or 3D printed tourniquet. You'll see our work. You'll be able to read our field trials. Help us. We're not the most amazing engineers or the most amazing doctors. We're just people who are trying to make things better. And we know we made it open source because we wanted the community to participate. Everything we do is not just for us. It's for everybody who comes after us. With the normal way of developing, you know, we always say we stand on the shoulders of giants, but with open source, when we work together, we build the giants on whose shoulders we stand.
We're going to leave it right there. That's Tarek Loubani. He's an emergency physician from Ontario, Canada, currently in the Gaza Strip. He's also an associate professor at the University of Western Ontario's Medical School. Tarek, please be safe. I'm so glad you're okay. And we'll talk to you very soon. Thanks for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Nora.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakout, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sam Husseini, Communications Director with the Institute for Public Accuracy, who talks about the desperation of the people in Gaza, which led to 6 weeks of protest and the subsequent massacre of Palestinian civilians by Israeli soldiers. James S. Henry of Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment, who examines the purpose and use of the multi-million-dollar slush fund controlled by President Trump's attorney, Michael Cohen. And activists speaking at a rally against the incarceration of women and girls at Connecticut's York Prison, who are challenging the nation's money bail system that discriminates against the poor. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A decade ago, during a peak in Colombia's 50-year civil war, the army lured young men into the city of Ocaña, 400 miles from the capital city of Bogota. According to the Guardian newspaper, once there, the young men were killed by soldiers and declared rebel fighters in order to boost the headcount of the number of leftist insurgents killed. The murdered civilians, often referred to as false positives, were in fact executed to boost U.S. military aid to Colombia. Many army officers involved in the killings were promoted to higher ranks. According to the Guardian newspaper, a new report co-authored by a retired Colombian police officer claims that 10,000 civilians were victims of false positive killings between 2002 and 2010, more than triple the number of murders earlier estimated by human rights groups. Even as Colombia's largest rebel army, the Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, laid down their arms in a peace deal in 2017, false positive killings are still occurring. Colombia President Juan Manuel Santos, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for negotiating the peace deal with FARC, was Minister of Defense from 2006 to 2009 at the height of the false positives killings. Human rights activists complain that neither Santos, former President Alvaro Uribe, or any Colombian general has yet been convicted for their role in these war crimes. Kentucky, a red state that embraced Obamacare, is changing course under Republican Governor Matt Bevin. The Bluegrass state is set to be the first in the U.S. to enforce work and community engagement requirements for some Medicaid recipients. Critics condemn the move, embraced by the Trump administration, for taking away health insurance from tens of thousands of low-income people. They note that the majority of Medicaid expansion enrollees in Kentucky are already employed, mostly in low-wage jobs. They argue that requiring people to work won't mean there will be employers that will hire them. To remain eligible, able-bodied working-age adults without dependents in Kentucky will have to work at least 20 hours a week, be a full-time student, or complete a number of other community engagement activities ranging from job searches and vocational training to community and caregiving service. Not meeting one of those criteria would lock people out of coverage for 6 months. Health advocacy groups have sued the state, asserting that the program violates the Social Security Act. During a rally of affordable housing activists on the steps of San Francisco City Hall, a white counter-protester, Sonia Trauss, a leader in the Bay Area Yimbyism movement, Yes in My Backyard, moved through the crowd and got involved in a confrontation with veteran activists from the city's communities of color. Trauss, whose efforts are funded by Silicon Valley executives like Yelp's CEO Jeremy Stoppelman, is a star among free market advocates seeking to build new housing in places like Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York. Young YIMBY members attend planning board meetings and have launched lawsuits against California cities and towns to overturn housing restrictions. According to In These Times, YIMBYism has taken off during the recent housing crisis, where it is common for 40% of an individual's income to be spent on rent or mortgage payments in urban neighborhoods plagued by gentrification. Racial tensions have spiked as Trauss has compared Latino anti-gentrification activists to Trump supporters who oppose immigration. Housing activists like Maria Zamudio of the Plaza 16 Coalition see YIMBY activists as a front group for for developers, landlords, and speculators. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The study and contrast between the horrific violence on the Israel-Gaza border and the posh celebration of the new U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem on May 14th couldn't have been more stark. As an estimated 50,000 Palestinians gathered along the frontier fence line in the sixth straight week of protests, Israeli army snipers opened fire, killing 58 people and injuring 2,700 more. This was the deadliest day since the Great March of Return protests began on March 30th, that are demanding an end to the 12-year Gaza blockade and the right to return to land now occupied by Israel. Since these protests began, at least 107 Palestinians have died, including children and journalists, and 12,000 others have been injured. While Israel justified the slaughter, asserting that protesters who attempted to damage or break through the border fence presented a threat to Israeli security, nations across the world have condemned Israel's use of excessive and disproportionate force. The deadly demonstrations coincided with the opening of the controversial new U.S. Jerusalem embassy on the 70th anniversary of Israel's founding and on the eve of Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, May 15th, when Palestinians commemorate the date when 700,000 Palestinian Arabs were expelled or fled from their homes during the 1948 Palestine War. Your reporter spoke with Sam Husseini, communications director with the Institute for Public Accuracy, who talks about the desperation of the people in Gaza, which led to 6 weeks of militant protests and the subsequent massacre of civilians by Israeli soldiers at the Gaza-Israel border.
People in Gaza are basically imprisoned by Israel. It's not so much a border as it is a prison, in that people in Gaza can't get in and get out for the most part. Even on the Egyptian side, when outsiders try to get in to break that blockade, people have tried to get ships in there to try to give some breathing room to the over 1 million people repressed in Gaza that Israelis intercepted, occasionally killing people who try to do that. So the circumstance in Gaza is dire constantly, and I think that that's part of the reason that you have people who are fundamentally saying, give me liberty or give me death. That's what these Palestinians are saying, that their lives have become so oppressive by what Israel has done for generations that they are willing to, you know, take these drastic actions that may well result in them being killed.
Sam, I did want to ask you about Israel's statements over these past 6 weeks and certainly today, justifying live sniper fire on what have been reported to be mostly or pretty much entirely unarmed civilians in a protest there at the border. Israel claims that the threat presented by these protesters, many of whom approached the border fence and some attempting to damage or cut through the border fence, was justification for the live sniper fire that has killed so many over the past 6 weeks.
I think that it violates the incredible number of legal precepts and ethical precepts. These people are only doing it because they're desperate and see no other recourse, because the international community has done virtually nothing for them, even though Israel has had them in this imprisoned situation for years and years. I heard the U.S. ambassador earlier today saying that they burn tires and, you know, they have kites. Palestinians burn tires to prevent the view of the snipers so that the Israelis will have a little bit of a rougher time shooting and killing them. They are not a military or meaningful threat. They are, in a sense, a symbolic threat to the notion of an Israel that continuously oppresses. And what they're saying is, you've got us in this pen, and you've prevented us from going to our homelands, and you'll shoot us if we try to, and you've made our lives so miserable here that we almost don't care anymore. We're just going to go to our homelands, and, you know, you shoot us, you shoot us. You know, as if Native Americans on the Trail of Tears, you know, decided to turn around and go back to their, to the homes that they were being forced from, and the U.S. military was shooting at them. You know, if that were to happen, Hollywood would make a very sympathetic movie about that.
Sam, with Trump's recent moves to relocate the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and full-bore support for expansion of Israeli settlements, it seems that any pretense of negotiations in the near future for a two-state solution is flat off the table. What does the future hold, given this powder keg that we've seen explode here on the Israel-Gaza border? What's next?
I think the so-called two-state solution, the U.S. as some kind of honest broker, has been a bit of a, something of a fantasy for some years now. And I think now it's a, you know, it's gone beyond fantasy to, you know, an utter depraved joke. I was never a key signatory to it, but the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement against Israel has really been a grassroots movement that has genuinely put some pressure on Israel. And I really take my hat off to a lot of the activists who led the way on that. That's something that's very tangible that people can do and they can plug into. And it's not just, you know, rhetoric. And I think that you're needing to see meaningful activism in countries like the United States, as well as new leadership emerging among Palestinian ranks in order to reassert their fundamental rights, because it literally is, you know, a matter of life and death for them, or perpetual servitude.
That was Sam Husseini, communications director with the Institute for Public Accuracy. Find more news and commentary on the desperate conditions in Gaza and Israel's deadly attack on the Palestinian border protest by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the Trump-Russia investigation rolls on, much of it behind closed doors, new revelations made headlines when Michael Avenatti, adult film star Stormy Daniels' attorney, disclosed that several major U.S.-based and international corporations had made large payments to Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. Avenatti is challenging the validity of the non-disclosure agreement that Daniels signed just before the 2016 presidential election, requiring her not to discuss an alleged affair she had with Trump in 2011. Avenatti released a report, much of it now verified, which stated that Michael Cohen's company, Essential Consultants, received $600,000 from AT&T, $1.2 million from pharmaceutical giant Novartis, $150,000 from Korea Aerospace, and $500,000 from Columbus Nova, an investment firm linked with Russian oligarch Viktor Vekselberg. These funds were deposited in the same LLC account from which Cohen paid Daniels $130,000 in hush money in October 2016. It's notable that all these companies that gave Cohen money had important business issues awaiting decisions from the U.S. federal government. Your reporter spoke with James S. Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale University, and senior editor at DC Report for Investigative Economics. Here he examines the purpose and use of the multi-million-dollar slush fund that Michael Cohen controlled and the legality of corporate money flowing directly or indirectly to a president through a third party in order to gain influence.
I suspect that in this case, this may well be something that Trump had no knowledge of, that Cohen was looking for, you know, kind of a freelancing opportunity to sell access to the president. And he talked these companies into this proposition on the basis of, you know, every one of them that was involved here. We know certainly AT&T with its, you know, Time Warner deal, Novartis with drug regulations, and you know, they were firms that really needed to have an inside track on government regulation. You know, this wasn't a whole lot of money for them in the aggregate compared to the potential value of having access to the president. But, you know, the Times had a detailed profile of Cohen in which they went into many of his other dodgy connections going back in time, and his uncle involved with the Lucchese mob and operating El Caribe, a place in kind of a watering hole from a mafiosa. And Michael maintained an investment in that club until 2016 after the election. The more interesting and I think important relationship here was the Vexelberg relationship. Viktor Vexelberg is one of the richest people in Russia. He has intimate relationships with many of the other GARCs that have come up in this kind of last 2 years in the story, in the investigation, people like Deripaska. Leo Blavatnik is a Russian-American who made a lot of donations to, you know, $6.3 million of political contributions to U.S. politicians in the 2016 election cycle. He's Vexelberg's partner and has been an investor with Deripaska, who's implicated in the Michael Flynn matter and the Manafort investigation. So this is a kind of a tiny, very influential crowd that, you know, some say have been basically deployed to gain influence over the Trump administration. And so this is kind of consistent with my favorite theory about what's been going on, which is not so much that Trump is a kind of a mole on the part of Putin. There is a whole investigation of collusion that Mueller is doing. But I'm just more struck by this kind of long history of kind of mobster activity. I mean, it's kind of organized crime has had a long-term relationship with Trump and with some of the people around him.
For myself and our audience, I'd like you to discuss a bit about the money that was coming into Michael Cohen's LLC from large corporations like AT&T and Novartis. Michael Cohen, as I understand it, was not a registered lobbyist. So what's the legality of hundreds of thousands of dollars and even over $1 million that was pumped into that account by some of these corporations? Is this a legal transaction to buy access to the president, or at least what they thought was buying access?
Clearly, if Trump had known about Michael Cohen's fundraising activities here and had sent him out to shake down these companies in exchange for access, that would have been, I think, over the line. But where you have a case here that the companies are kind of responding to Michael's invitations, they're hiring him, you know, for alleged consulting services. You know, I think that, you know, there's an argument that the president didn't even know about it. I mean, we don't know that for sure, but, you know, we have to benefit of the doubt. So I think in this case, what we have is foolhardy behavior. It certainly has, you know, impropriety written all over it. It's the avoiding, in terms of avoiding the appearance of impropriety. But it may be a case of where it's hard to prove that there was any kind of real exchange for services. In fact, just the opposite. These companies have come away with their kind of black eyes as a result of this. And it's not clear that he ever delivered anything. We may be on the verge of learning much more about a whole web of relationships that Michael Cohen was involved with. There was this strange meeting at the Trump Tower in December 2016 in which one of the senior investors from Qatar met with Michael Flynn and with Trump and also with Rick Perry, the Department of Energy cabinet executive in the U.S. And who knows what they were discussing, but the meeting happened just a couple days after this deal in which Qatar invested in the big Russian state-owned company Rosneft and basically helped to buy a transaction that involved about 20% of Rosneft. There are all kinds of allegations in the Steele memorandum for those of you know who are really down in the weeds here on the Trump investigation. That transaction with the Qataris featured prominently, and there we have basically Cohen, you know, holding hands with all these people during this kind of very dubious meeting that day. So I suspect that we're going to find out much more about people that he maybe recruited, that he tried to recruit. But, you know, this is a fellow who's been deeply involved in the Trump administration for at least a decade and probably longer. And, you know, there's probably more to come out about him.
That was James S. Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment and senior editor at DC Report for Investigative Economics. Find links to articles examining Trump-era pay-to-play schemes by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Connecticut was one of many states and cities around the U.S. that raised money and awareness to bail women out of jails and prisons for Mother's Day this year. The Connecticut Bail Fund, working with a dozen other groups, raised about $30,000 and bailed out 30 women. The funds were used to bail out 26 women from the state's only women's prison, York Correctional Institute in Niantic, with another four bailed out from immigration jail. While these women are charged with crimes, they haven't been convicted and are incarcerated only because they can't afford to pay bail. The groups participating in the Mother's Day bailout, as it's called, are not simply raising money to release women from jail, but are challenging the entire money bail system, which discriminates against the poor, the population most frequently caught up in the criminal justice system. On May 8th, the coalition of groups taking part in the Mother's Day bailout held a rally in a park adjacent to the York Women's Prison, where advocates, including many formerly incarcerated women, shouted their encouragement to the women still behind bars. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the rally and brings us excerpts of several of those who spoke.
Ana Maria Rivera Forestieri works at the Connecticut Bail Fund.
There's nearly 1,000 women that are currently incarcerated in this cage, in this state-sponsored cage, that are not going to be able to go home to their loved ones. And so throughout the last couple of months, through the work that we've been doing, and through the stories that some of which you're going to be hearing about today, we've been learning about the human rights abuses that women are experiencing inside this facility. And so we want to stand in love and solidarity, but we also want to shed light into what's happening right here in Connecticut. Some of the abuses that women are experiencing, from sexual harassment to sexual abuse to medical neglect, from immigration agents coming into this facility impersonating lawyers and tricking people. We want to let people know what's happening inside this facility. And we want to send a message of love and solidarity that we're here, that we love you, that we stand with you, that we're going to fight every single day until all of you come home to your communities.
Yes! Woo!
Repeat after me. It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to win.
It is our duty to win.
We must love and protect each other.
We must love and protect each other.
We have nothing to lose but our change.
Tahiba Bain yelled to the women inside York about a new state law to protect their rights.
I'm here today because I want to let the women at York know that for anyone that's in there that is pregnant, you have the right today to not be shackled during transportation. Throughout this past session of the legislation, we have been successful in passing Senate Bill 13 for an act of fair treatment for incarcerated women. You are now allowed and supposed to be provided sanitary napkins free of charge. The people that are pregnant, you're not supposed to be handcuffed, shackled during labor and after delivery. So know your rights, ladies. You have that right, and you have to fight for your rights. I was in York CI many, many years ago, maybe three or four times. So today I want to let you know that even though you're behind that wall today, you can be out here tomorrow doing the same thing. And don't forget about the sisters that you leave when you do leave, because they're going to need your help like you need our help today.
Up, up with liberation, down with incarceration.
Up, up with liberation, down with incarceration.
Up, up with liberation, down, down with incarceration.
Up, up with liberation, down with incarceration.
Hi, my name is Nicole Kennedy. I was just released by the Bail Committee Fund on Friday. incarcerated. The Bail Fund Committee came and got me Friday. April 7th, I did a praise dance in order to raise money to bring women home. You would have not told me I would be one of those women. Today, I stand here and I say, I'm free. Praise the Lord, I'm free. No more bound, no more chains holding me. My soul is resting. It's a blessing. I'm free today to fight for other women that was in there with me, sat with me. 7 days in a medical lockup. You go nowhere for 7 days. Your mental state of mind goes through torment. You don't know when you're getting out. You are a victim of the state. Today, my fear is, I went to court today, and my fear was they could revoke my bond if they feel like it and place me back in for heartaches of 3 years ago. My past is my past. Judge me for my present, because my past, I can't live by that anymore. You tell me to change, you tell me to rehabilitate, then leave my past in my past and judge me for my present. And that's why my presence is out here, to tell those ladies that watch me leave Friday, I am out here still fighting to get the rest of you out. I will not sit still, and I will not be quiet anymore like I was told in those walls. I was told when to speak, when not to speak. And if I spoke, I was told to shut up. I had no value. I had no opinion. I had no say-so. Today, I got a lot to say. You will not treat us the way you have anymore. We have rights. We have the right to fight for what we believe in, and we believe in that these walls will no longer hold us back. I'm going forward to say thank you to this committee and these people that are out here rallying. Thank you for freeing me. You came and got me. So I need to come back and get the rest of them. Ladies, let's do this.
Amen. That was Anna Maria Forasteri, co-director of the Connecticut Bail Fund, to Heba Bain and Nicole Kennedy, speaking at a rally in solidarity with incarcerated women at Connecticut's York Correctional Institute on May 8th. Learn more about groups challenging the nation's money bail system by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFI in Ithaca, New York, KRBX in Boise, Idaho, KMUD in Garberville, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Another school, another massacre. We thought, foolishly, that the school killings in Florida were a turning point. Demonstrations across the country raged against mass murders, the National Rifle Association gun lobby, and impotent politicians wanting to pray rather than pass laws to protect children. Until now. Until a teenager in Texas, spurned by a girl, explodes at a high school and sends 10 people to the next world. Here we go again. No national politician, from the president to local mayor, has a clue. Not one. This is America at the first quarter of a new century. Nothing even comes close. We tire, for it's all too familiar. Young men, lonely, alone, and unloved, fueled by explosive testosterone, turn school grounds into the wild, wild west, and teach lessons of death in classrooms, launching themselves, if they survive, into the modern-day dungeons of prison and loss. What can we do? Nothing. Nothing. Until wait. Until the next time. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. In America's poorest states and is spreading as we speak. First came Kentucky, then a slew of others, Arizona, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Colorado. And if you think about it, these are, for the most part, conservative states, and yet these are places where teachers, among the most poorly paid state and local workers at a public institution, are walking out and uniting to demand better pay and better support for their mission. Teaching kids. In recent years, the assault on teaching as a valued profession has left me shocked and disturbed. Why? Because teachers are presumed to be liberal and tend to support Democratic candidates. There's yet another reason that underlies all of this. Conservative hatred of public schools and their affection for private and charter schools. But as teachers rise and fight back, they are winning. And showing that they and labor can fight back and win. This insidious war against teachers is a war against those they teach, children, often poor children, often your children. Good teachers can open minds. Surely the nation needs more of that, right? From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Thank you.
Is there a new mode of hegemonic warfare taking the form of pro-democracy movements? How have institutions like the National Endowment for Democracy and affiliated non-governmental organizations advanced American imperial interests from communist Poland and Yugoslavia to Ukraine and Armenia? Are there aspects to the Nicaraguan protests not being discussed in mainstream media? What geostrategic goals might the U.S. be hoping to achieve through a weaponized student movement in Nicaragua? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we explore a rarely discussed weapon of modern warfare, referred to as the Colored Revolution, or fake democracy movements. In our first half hour, geopolitical analyst and writer F. William Engdahl breaks down some of the history and evolution of this stratagem, as captured in his recent book, Manifest Destiny. In our second half hour, we hear from Managua-based Stephen Sefton of the Tortilla Con Sal Collective about recent events in Nicaragua, which are beginning to resemble events leading to the soft coup in Ukraine. On this week's program, one of the most important weapons of warfare developed by a NATO country, Colored Revolutions in the Nicaraguan Case Study. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 25th, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe Akin, the homeland of the Métis and the traditional territory of the Nahiyawak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The Contract for the Government of Change, stipulated by Luigi Di Maio and Matteo Salvini on behalf of the Five Star Movement and the League, on the one hand, confirms Italy's membership of the Atlantic Alliance with the United States of America as a privileged ally, and on the other, promises an open-minded attitude to Russia, which should be perceived not as a threat, but as an economic and commercial partner, which would imply the withdrawal of sanctions to be rehabilitated as a strategic interlocutor for the resolution of regional crises, and even as a potential partner for NATO. The formula is not new. In June 2016, Prime Minister Renzi assured President Putin that the Cold War is now history, and that Europe and Russia can be excellent neighbors. A month later, at the Warsaw summit, Renzi signed the EU-NATO strategic pact against Russia. How can the new government cease perceiving Russia as a threat and act accordingly while it remains a member of NATO, which, under the command of the privileged ally, is increasingly committed to combating the Russian threat? That comes from the article, Video for Italy, A New Government, the Same Privileged Ally of U.S. NATO, by Manlio Di Nucci, posted May 24th, originally appearing on Il Manifesto. The elections are over, but the electoral process in Venezuela has not ended. Maduro has requested a full recount and verification of ballots to convince public opinion that the election was legitimate and transparent. It is tempting to compare Venezuela with other countries on the best practice of elections, but that is not the point or requirement for transparency. Venezuela would not be more democratic if it could show that some percentage is higher or lower than in some other country. Venezuela is democratic because the majority of the people made it so by exercising their constitutional right to vote freely and independently, and, we may add, despite the international interference. That comes from the article, Elections in Venezuela, Democratic, Fair, and Transparent, by Nino Paglicia, posted May 24th. Yulia and perhaps Sergei ahead are only allowed to publicly say what UK authorities permit, Britain scripting her remarks, letting her say only what her captors permit. According to former UK ambassador, human rights activist Craig Murray, Yulia's comment about, quote, not wishing to avail myself of Russian embassy services, unquote, mistranslated what she said. Clearly, she recited UK scripted remarks, Reuters complicit in the deception. Yulia is a Russian national, visiting Britain only to see her father. Except for a brief April 5th scripted-sounding phone conversation with her cousin Victoria back home on a temporary phone given her, not her own cell phone she's not permitted to have, she and her father, Sergei, have been held incommunicado, currently at an unknown location, denied phone and computer contact with their relatives in Russia. That comes from the article, Yulia Skripal's Scripted Public Remarks. The Skripals are UK hostages at an unidentified location, by Stephen Lentman, posted May 24th. If it now a matter of public record that running a torture prison is a good career move, supported by both parties in Congress. And it is also interesting to note how fiercely the CIA fought to keep from having to reveal details of Haspel's career or even the records of the torture prison. It is unlikely that reports relating to events that took place 16 years ago could continue to be classified because they would reveal intelligence sources and methods. Rather, they remain top secret because they are potentially embarrassing to the participants, to those who directed and approved the activity, and to the organizations involved. In that light, the Haspel confirmation's acceptance of zero accountability is a perfect example of precisely what is wrong with the United States government. That comes from the article, For U.S. Congress, Running a Torture Prison is a Good Career Move, by Philip Giraldi, posted May 24th, originally appearing at Strategic Culture Foundation. Israel needs conflict and the destabilization of Syria and Iran, Hezbollah's suppliers, so that Israel can seize southern Lebanon. The American neoconservatives, who are firmly entrenched in the Trump regime, are de facto Israeli agents. Moreover, they are committed to American hegemony, which requires the overthrow of independent governments. Putin is betting that Washington's pursuit of hegemony in the Middle East will cost Washington hegemony in Europe. If Putin does not win this bet, he had better be prepared for the war that Washington and Israel are aiming directly at Russia. That comes from the article, Washington's Sabotage of Russian Diplomacy, Putin's Peace Efforts Are Coming to Naught, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted May 24th, originally appearing on Paul Craig Roberts Institute for Political Economy. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. After decades of propaganda, the general public is becoming more adept at discerning the pretexts for war that are principally evoked by political leaders about the need to go to war with this or that country. There are, however, new ways of engaging regime changes that don't involve lies about weapons of mass destruction or self-defense against exaggerated threats from terrorists or communists. A relatively new instrument, which involves new innovations of social media and psychological research, is known alternatively as colored revolutions or fake democracy movements. The idea is that members of a society will be convinced to destabilize their own country in the name of democracy or freedom or human rights. A replacement for the governing authorities will be sought, which principally advances the aspirations of U.S. hegemonic rule, not the ideals animating popular struggles. A new book by author and Global Research NewsHour past guest F. William Engdahl explores this topic in depth. The book is called Manifest Destiny, Democracy as Cognitive Dissonance. It has recently been published by Mine Books in Germany. F. William Engdahl is an award-winning geopolitical analyst, strategic risk consultant, author, professor, and lecturer. He's been researching and writing about the world political scene for more than 30 years. His various books on geopolitics, the interaction between international power politics, economics, and geography, have been translated into 14 foreign languages, from Chinese to French, from German to Japanese. He has lectured on contemporary geopolitics as visiting professor at Beijing University of Chemical Technology and delivers talks and private seminars around the world on different aspects of economics and politics with a focus on political risk. A regular contributor to a number of international publications on economics and political affairs, including Asia Times, FinancialSense.com, The Real News, and RT.com Op-Edge, William is a research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization and a member of the editorial board of Eurasia magazine. He currently lives in Germany and, in addition to writing and giving interviews on current events, consults as a political risk economist for various private organizations, major European banks, and private investor groups. In an interview conducted in early May, Mr. Engdahl explained the origin of a new mode of military intervention that had its origins in the Central Intelligence Agency.
It came out of a project proposed during the Reagan administration in 1983 by Reagan's CIA director, William Casey, Bill Casey. And at that time, the CIA was under the spotlight in Senate hearings and exposés around the world, the revelations by CIA whistleblowers for their involvement in the Pinochet coup in Chile, for the Iranian toppling of Mossadegh in the 50s and so forth. All that was beginning to come out, and it was having a huge negative effect. So Casey proposed doing what the CIA does, but doing it privately, and that resulted in creation of something by the U.S. Congress called the National Endowment for Democracy, using non-governmental organizations in a coherent way. I call them fake democracy NGOs, and you can give a better description in the actual book itself as I detail which NGOs are used for that. The monies come from the U.S. government or from certain private foundations, and they have systematically targeted nation after nation to topple regimes that are not friendly to the Washington agenda.
Bill Casey's first target for NED, advanced regime change, was communist Poland. As described in Engdahl's book, Poland was the weakest link in Moscow's chain of command. Starting in the mid-1980s, the NED funneled technology and equipment, including fax machines, copiers, computers, and phones, along with millions of dollars, into Lech Walesa's Solidarnosc, an independent, non-communist labor movement.
They funneled millions of dollars, U.S. taxpayer dollars, into Lech Walesa's Solidarnosc and created mass protests on the streets of Poland at a point where the communist government was simply powerless to intervene, among other reasons, because unbeknownst to most people, the Polish Pope, John Paul II, had just been elected, and he met with Ronald Reagan and entered into a secret agreement, and this was later confirmed by Reagan's national security advisor, a secret agreement to bring down the communist regime in Poland, and they did that very successfully. Once they brought down the regime, they immediately privatized everything, but they freed up the zloty against the dollar, so the zloty fell like a lit stone. And then if you suddenly had dollar assets, like Western investors who were on the inside of this game did, you could buy up some of the crown jewels of the Polish economy for pennies on the dollar. And the losers in this were the Polish people.
William Engdahl mentions three more primary targets for NED-style interventions: the Soviet Union, Yugoslavia, and China.
In the case of the Soviet Union, they managed to bring in a CIA asset by the name of Boris Yeltsin, and use Yeltsin to simply what I call in the book the rape of Russia, to literally steal and rob from the Russian state and the Russian people almost anything of value if they could get their kleptocratic hands on. And in the case of Yugoslavia, it was the ignition that led to the explosion of a civil war and completely destroyed that country. In the case of China, the Chinese government somehow managed to get wind of what was going on and kicked out certain NGO operatives that were connected with the U.S. State Department and the U.S. ambassador at that time to Beijing, James Lilly, who was a former CIA crony of George Bush Sr.
Is it possible to detail some of the money flows? Where, like, how does it translate on the ground, if I could put it that way?
How it translates on the ground is the money goes to all sorts of NGOs in target countries that pop up out of the thin air. In the period of the Ukraine color revolution, the so-called Orange Revolution in 2003-2004, and also in Georgia, that's next door, they began focusing on election processes and having poll watchers, fake poll watchers, and then coordinating with embedded media like CNN or BBC to put out a certain message.
William Engdahl mentioned a Serbian organization called OTPAR, which he claims was trained by U.S. intelligence and it was instrumental in the overthrow of Slobodan Milosevic. This organization would evolve and become a template for further military operations in areas where the U.S. had strategic interests at stake. Engdahl explained the mechanics of this OTPAR model of regime overthrow.
That later transformed itself into a professional organization, keeping the cover of this successful Serbian regime change organization that they call CANVAS, C-A-N-V-A-S, but the same people are involved. They're very secretive about where they get their funding from, but it's clear that it's coordinated with the U.S. State Department intelligence. And what they do, they serve as the logistics training center, the people on the ground from the U.S. government in usually through the embassy, begin recruiting student activists usually. They're the most effective. They're trained in techniques very much similar to what we see going on today in Armenia. But they're trained in techniques to discredit the power and the authority of authoritarian governments or governments who try to resist mass protest. The techniques have been refined with Facebook and Twitter. Techniques are constantly being refined. The RAND Corporation, Research and Development Corporation, as detailed in the book, Manifest Destiny, is developing techniques they call swarming. And they did a study of all or most of the major world brilliant military commanders from Alexander the Great to Genghis Khan, Napoleon, and others, and their military tactics. And then they applied this to these mass protests. They used Twitter and Facebook to communicate with groups of protesters. And then their tactics will be protest and run, regroup in different parts of the city, and then keep the government completely off guard, keep the military or the security police off guard, so that the power of the state looks like it's impotent. And that begins to undermine the authority.
The Arab Spring protests inspired popular struggles around the world. Taking a close look at one of the most dynamic of these revolutions, the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, William Engdahl explains that the Arab Spring protests were clearly influenced and orchestrated by hegemonic U.S. imperial interests.
I've spoken with some of the students who were in those protests, and they deeply believed that they were fighting for democracy and human rights. And that, without that, it doesn't work. It's not convincing. So that's an essential element of it. But what most of the students didn't realize is that behind the scenes or front organizations of a political terrorist cult called the Muslim Brotherhood, which was created in Egypt by British intelligence in the 1920s and in the time of the Arab Spring, was backed by the American State Department as the alternative to kind of much like Mubarak or Libya's Gaddafi or Ben Ali in Tunisia. And so the demonstrations spread, were successful. Once Mubarak stepped down, the Muslim Brotherhood and the U.S. government moved to have early elections, and the only organized force that was prepared to win early elections was the Muslim Brotherhood, and that's where you've got Mohamed Morsi and a government controlled by the Muslim Brotherhood and supported by U.S. State Department and the CIA, which had been working, collaborating in cahoots with the Muslim Brotherhood since the early 1950s. In any event, the students were suddenly completely left in the lurch by Washington and the U.S. government because their agenda was to bring in this political terrorist organization.
In terms of financing these revolutions, how much of that funding is coming from, you know, authorized by Congress versus off-the-book financing? And where is the off-the-book financing coming from?
There are private foundations that work in connection with the U.S. government finance, the National Endowment for Democracy, NEP. And the breakdown of that is very difficult simply because they don't disclose in an open and honest way fully what they're financing. It's very difficult to trace.
William Engdahl mentioned in his book one of the mechanisms financing the looting or raping, as he put it, of Soviet Russia. It involved the use of gold obtained by the Japanese during the Second World War from colonized China, Mongolia, and Indonesia, and hidden in caves in the Philippines. Philippine leader Ferdinand Marcos came across this gold and attempted to sell it on world markets with the help of CIA asset Adnan Khashoggi. Khashoggi was friendly with George Herbert Walker Bush, a former CIA director.
So they used that Philippine gold, the Marcos gold, as collateral to create derivatives that were used to nominally back up the buying up of the Russian state assets by certain so-called Russian oligarchs who laundered the money through Western banks in Switzerland and the Jersey Islands offshore, the UK, and other places. And all of that was done under the supervision of the CIA. Edmund Safra's bank was one of the banks involved in that as well.
When we look at different revolutions that might be happening all over the world, can we safely conclude that they're all, stage managed and fake, or is there a way that we can distinguish between a genuine and a fake democracy revolution?
Sometimes very difficult. For example, the ongoing protests in Yerevan and Armenia. Armenia is a former Soviet, part of the Soviet Union as well, and a very strategic country for the security of Russia.
In April, protests in Armenia resulted in the resignation of Prime Minister Serge Sargsyan. Engdahl discusses the similarities between the popular revolt against Sargsyan and similar revolutions in Ukraine and other Soviet satellites.
Yes, the same U.S. government NGOs and private foundations that work with those U.S. government NGOs, like the National Endowment for Democracy, are very active in Armenia and have been active in Armenia on all the kinds of financing operations that have been connected with color revolutions in the past. This time, the opposition leader, Pashinyan, goes out of his way to stress that he's not against Armenia's membership in the Eurasian Economic Union or against Russia, but he's against the corruption of the Sargsyan, the former government, and the fact that the Armenian economy is in such bad shape. So there are genuine grievances that the population has, but the point is the U.S. State Department is very much on the scene. They're in telephone contact with Pashinyan, and all the indications are it hasn't been, at its initiation, a color revolution. The U.S. State Department and the intelligence agencies are for sure trying to figure out the best way to take advantage of that in Azerbaijan. Parliamentarians from Azerbaijan are saying, let's take advantage of this chaos in Armenia and retake Nagorno-Karabakh, which is majority Armenian ethnic population that seceded in 1991 from Azerbaijan. So in some cases, it's a very difficult distinction. Like I say, in the case of Armenia, I would say the jury's still out. My own sense is that it is being manipulated in the direction of a color revolution by the U.S. government, State Department, intelligence agency. But it's not 100% clear yet.
What do you think? I mean, it seems to me that you've mentioned the. There was the revolution or U.S. interference in Russia and the looting of Russia throughout the 1990s. Yeltsin was eventually removed, and Vladimir Putin came in. And since Vladimir Putin has arrived, I think the future of any more of this kind of U.S. intervention within Russia seems to be very, dim, as is the case, it seems to me, in China. Again, as you mentioned, the that revolution, that fake democratic revolution, as you put it, it does not seem to have prevailed. So what are your thoughts about the future of this mode of this weapon of this fake democratic method mechanism of warfare? Are the other states catching on? Are they going to be able to defend themselves from this? Are they learning their lessons?
Yes and no, I would say. Russia has certainly learned its lesson, and the Russian security services figuring out the pattern in Ukraine, Georgia. And they passed a bill in the Duma called the Law Against Undesirable NGOs, which various NGOs screamed and hollered about. China has made a similar crackdown on the NGOs. And other countries, smaller countries, I would say Armenia is a good example, are less experienced in this kind of thing and therefore less prepared to deal with it in an effective way. So it's very uneven. It's very uneven. And these are highly insidious operations where you have suddenly NGOs popping up and calling for democracy and more freedom for whatever in some country, whether it be Egypt or whatever. And then it's picked up by select Western media like CNN or BBC as a genuine grassroots movement, and the focus on the dictatorial regime, so most regimes don't want to get a bad press.
F. William Engdahl's book is Manifest Destiny, Democracy as Cognitive Dissonance. It is available on Amazon. For more information about William Engdahl, check out his website, William Engdahl, that's ENGDAHL.com, or read his articles posted at globalresearch.ca. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. On
On April 18th, anti-government protests sprang up across Nicaragua, triggered by reforms by the Sandinista government of the country's social security system. The opposition protests, led by students and backed by Nicaragua's business lobby, are accusing the government and its leader, Daniel Ortega, of violent crackdowns and repression of dissent. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, an autonomous arm of the Organization of American States, conducted research in a preliminary report, principally held the government accountable for the violence, which they say included torture and murder. The IACHR documents 76 people killed and 868 injured since April 18th. Nicaraguan officials are currently in talks with students and business leaders to resolve weeks of tension with the increasingly unpopular Ortega. Are the events of the last month in Nicaragua representing a shift toward democracy that was left by the wayside under a once promising guerrilla leader? Or is this an example of the latest colored revolution designed to advance U.S. imperial interests in the country and the region? To discuss this question, we turn to Stephen Sefton. He is a community worker and co-worker of the anti-imperialist Tortilla Con Sal Media Collective, based out of Managua. Welcome, Stephen.
Hi, thank you very much for inviting me to talk on your program, Michael.
Yes, so it sounds like you got a little bit of rain there in the background.
Yeah, I know. Everybody's very pleased because the rainy season started on time, and which is very important for local farmers and for the economy as a whole.
Uh-huh. Now, the mainstream Western press is speaking of brutal crackdowns on peaceful protesters of the Ortega government. And, this description kind of resembles much of the reporting on the Euromaidan in late 2013, early 2014. I was wondering if you could just give us your group's interpretation of events, maybe starting with a breakdown of the circumstances that led up to the student protest of April 18th.
Yeah, and I think you have to look at the history of the last 5, 6, 7 years here in Nicaragua. From 2010 onwards, the Nicaraguan economy has been the most successful economy in Central America, apart from Panama, but Panama's such a special case. And in terms of its immediate neighbors, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and Costa Rica, Nicaragua has been by far the most successful economy from 2010 to date. And that explains, in large part, the incredible popularity of President Ortega in electoral terms. He won the election in 2011 with over 60% of the vote, and he won the presidential election in 2016 with just over 70% of the vote. So, and both those elections were regarded as free and fair by international observers. However, begrudgingly, they may have acknowledged that the vote reflected the will of Nicaraguan people. Or the European Union, for example, had an observer mission. They acknowledged the legitimacy of the vote. And many other election observers did as well. So then the question is, what has happened between 2016 and 2018 to trigger this incredibly violent series of events that began on April the 18th? And our answer to that question is that it's very much, as you pointed out in your introduction there, one of these color revolutions, very similar to what happened in Ukraine, very similar to what happened in Libya and Syria back in 2011. And so then the question is, how seriously does one take the preliminary report of the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights, which is a body very much under the thumb of the United States? It has its secretaries in Washington, and many people here in Latin America regard the Organization of American States as little more than a ministry for the colonies. Borrowing that term from the Spanish Empire and translating it to the current attempts of the United States to reimpose its imperialist dominion over Latin America and the Caribbean.
The OAS did exclude Cuba from shortly after the revolution, right?
Yeah, and of course, and it, when it was originally set up, it was set up just at the beginning of the Cold War. And the, but let's not get distracted by the history of the OAS. I'm trying to realize what the OAS is. You just have to look at the way it's behaved towards Venezuela and its disgraceful interventionist behavior in Venezuela, completely in breach of its very own rules. So anything coming out of the Organization of American States is highly questionable because it's always biased against any progressive government. And the same is true of this preliminary report. Now, the figures may be right, but it's completely impractical on their part to say that they carried out a sufficient investigation to be able to know where responsibility lies for the violence. They were in the, they arrived in the country on Friday, April 17th, and they've been in the country for precisely 4 days. And they're a very small delegation, and not more than a dozen people as far as I know. So how is it possible in just 4 days for these 12 people to adequately investigate the events that took place over the previous month? And it's just absurd. So then one has to say, well, why did the events start? Now, the supposed trigger, the alleged trigger for the protests was a social security form by the government. That was interpreted as being anti-worker and anti-pensioner. Well, in fact, the reverse is true. As so often in these cases, as so often we've seen in these color revolutions, the immediate pretext for the violence that erupts turns out to be false on closer examination, and that's very much the case here. Because what happened was that the business organization withdrew from the negotiations about the social security form because they were the ones that were going to pay more. And it's true that there were modest increases for workers and a slight cut in benefits for pensioners, but that cut in benefits for pensioners was more than compensated for because they were going to be, as a result of the reform, they were for the first time ever in Nicaragua's, in the history of Nicaragua's social security system, all pensioners would be entitled to the same healthcare rights as active workers contributing to the system. So, and why did the business organization withdraw? Because they were the ones that were going to have to pay more. And if you, this is very important to understand the contradictions in the subsequent protests. The fundamental contradiction is this. The students protested a social security reform that was actually more favorable to the workers than the business side's proposal. And their protests are being supported. Look at who's supporting their protests. People like Marco Rubio, Ileana Rosletten, and Bob Menendez, and Donald Trump and Mike Pence, you know, and they support the protests because they're saying that it's a legitimate call for democracy in Nicaragua, which is one of the most democratic countries in the region. And the other thing to bear in mind is that it's big local corporate businesses that are also supporting the protests. Now, if you look at that, people need to ask, why is that? Do they really believe that big corporate capital and the United States authorities and right-wing U.S. senators could care less about democracy in Nicaragua? No, I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I would think so. But I don't know. I guess that speaks to the grip of the propaganda systems.
Yeah, and I think, well, the angle that you're taking is absolutely right. In that, you know, this is very, very similar to the coup in the Ukraine in 2014 and the NATO-backed coups against Libya and Syria back in 2011. But let's leave it there for now and look at what actually happened. On the Wednesday, the 18th of April, there were protests by students and a few pensioners, but the main pensioners organization, the one that has represented pensioners in Nicaragua in negotiations over the last two or three years accepted the reform because they recognized that overall it was beneficial to pensioners in Nicaragua. So then mainly it was the students that were protesting on Wednesday the 18th. And what happened was that rival groups of students and rival groups of young government supporters clashed with the protesting students, and the police then had to intervene to maintain order. And that is where the violence began. And on Thursday the 19th, the situation dramatically changed, because what you then had were very determined groups of armed extremists who were deliberately attacking the police. Now, the image projected in the international corporate media, of course, is of peaceful protests. But the protests from Thursday the 19th on, and from late on Wednesday night, Wednesday the 18th on, were far from peaceful, and they involved violent groups actually attacking police stations, attacking, they burnt down a building in the University of León, the National Autonomous University in León. There's some damage to other university precincts in Managua. But the fundamental thing that gives the lie to the suggestion that the protests were peaceful is that they attacked the municipal offices in Granada, they attacked municipal offices in Chinandega, in Masaya, they attacked municipal offices in Estelí, and on Friday the 20th of April, on that night, when two students died, nobody knows how they died. They were shot, but nobody knows by whom, because the police were not firing live rounds. The authorities here insist that the police were not firing live rounds. And what happened that night here in Estelí, where I live, is that a group of between 500 and 600 attackers attacked the Alcaldía. They attacked an adjacent building that was used as a store for food for Nicaragua's extensive social programs. And they also tried to ransack a local supermarket. Now, in that battle, it was a five-hour pitched battle. In that battle, around 1,000 of these homemade mortar rounds were fired. And those arms are they're lethal. And also, some around 16 or 17 Molotov cocktails were thrown at the Alcaldía, just at the Alcaldía, that's the municipal authority office.
Are you talking about the larger group, or is it maybe just a minority faction that are doing these things?
No, the extremist groups are very clever and have worked a very carefully planned operational scheme. They intermingle with protesting students, then provoke the violence, then the students get caught up in the violence, and that is what has led to deaths among the students. But if you analyze, as you said in the report, the Inter-American Commission report, they talk about over 860 wounded, and now that may well be true. But of those wounded, around 200 are police. And of the dead, at least three or four are police. And so among those 76 dead, and let's assume just for argument's sake, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. I don't think the number of dead associated with the protest is that large, but let's say it is. Of those, at least half are police, bystanders, or government supporters. At least half. And the rest may be students or protesters or because what we can know for sure, and this is very well substantiated by testimony, is that the a substantial number of the people involved in the violent attacks are paid young delinquents that have been recruited from barriers and they're paid local districts. In different cities of Managua, León, Estelí, Masaya, and other parts of the country, and they're bussed in to different parts of the country to carry out the attacks. they're paid between $10 and $15 a day. That's very well substantiated. So then, I mean, if you look at the events of the previous week, just of last week, there were repeated attacks on police stations, even though the police had been withdrawn from the streets. This is what's so extraordinary here in Nicaragua. Can you imagine any other country in the world where, faced with these kinds of protests, the government that's accused of being a dictatorship would withdraw the police from the streets? And so what happened at that point? At that point, you'd have expected the protesters to say, oh, well, we can protest peacefully now because the police aren't on the streets to repress us. But instead of that, what did they do? They attacked police stations. They attacked police stations in Masaya, in Matagalpa, and in Jinotega. And in those attacks, they injured police officers and wounded at least three government supporters.
Saying that very early on the government started to back away from any repressive violence, but the opposition, forces, including these individuals. I mean, are we talking gangs here? They were increasing their violence.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they increased their violence. And on April the 21st, President Daniel Ortega announced that. He was proposing a national dialogue, and the business organization here accepted that. Then on April Sunday the 22nd, he said that he was withdrawing, he was instructing the Social Security Institute to withdraw the proposed Social Security reform, which in any case wasn't going to be implemented until July. And may well have required debate in the National Assembly before it could be implemented in any case. So... and when he announced that, at the same time that he announced the withdrawal of the reform measure, he announced that he was requesting the Episcopal Conference here, which is an organization of the Catholic bishops of the Catholic Church here in Nicaragua, to mediate the national dialogue. And at that point, the police operations began to be take a much lower profile, and in order to give the national dialogue a chance. Now, you tell me, Michael, in what other country in the world would the government make such a big concession to extremely violent protests? There was nothing peaceful about the protests that attacked municipal offices and police stations. And then on top of that, following that weekend of the 21st and the 22nd, the relatively small opposition groups, just to give you an idea, and there are something like 15,000 members of transport organizations in Managua. Of those, around 200 were trying to impose a strike on their fellow transport workers, taxi drivers, bus drivers, and so forth. And what they did was they kind of set up roadblocks around the city, and they were actually attacking taxis with passengers in them and attacking buses with passengers in them. They even attacked a bus that was carrying children with disability from a special school, taking them back home. And there's been nothing peaceful about those protests, but at the same time, amid all that chaos, the opposition did hold peaceful protest marches, but those were very much the exception rather than the rule, because over the last month, the population here in Nicaragua has been subject to really serious intimidation, and there are roadblocks set up across the country that are refusing to let trucks with supplies of all kinds circulate freely. And there have been various incidents in which patients in ambulances have suffered as a result of the roadblocks. Last week, a pregnant woman that was on her way to hospital over in the east of the country on the Atlantic coast went into convulsions in the ambulance because it had been held at three hours at one of the roadblocks. And the team in the ambulance were unable to stabilize, and she died. And so, if people want to talk about human rights, and that's one of the things that's being debated as we speak in the national dialogue process, because what the overwhelming majority of people in Nicaragua are indignant about is that their rights are being denied, their rights to freedom of movement, their rights to be able to get to hospitals and get to school and just carry on their normal life. That all those basic rights are being denied them by a minority of people who are calling for the overthrow of the government. Now, on that score, it's worth bearing in mind that even Luis Almagro, who's about as under the thumb of the United States imperialists as you can get, the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, even he has rejected those demands by the right-wing extremists because he says it's undemocratic.
Uh-huh. How do you think things are going to turn out? Is it going to be like Ukraine, or are we going to? Is the country going to recover? And like, is it?
Well, you can ask me, and if you ask me in 10 hours' time, I'll have a different answer because it's a real roller coaster.
And
sometimes you think everything's going to work out all right, and other times it just looks as though civil war is just around the corner. And it's just it's impossible to say what's going to happen. But the only thing in that respect, the main question is the government's bent over backwards to promote dialogue and make the dialogue possible. The opposition, on the other hand, have set preconditions. They're very aggressive. In the installation of the dialogue, they were very aggressive. They clearly don't want the dialogue because talks won't get them what they want, which is Ortega out. That's what they want. But the difficulty that they have is that the vast majority of people in Nicaragua sympathize with the government because the government has given them the best economic conditions anybody in Nicaragua has ever experienced in their lifetime. And that's no exaggeration. And if you look at Nicaragua's history, I was born in, I'm 66, I'll be 6, I'm 65, I'll be 66 this year. I've lived in Nicaragua for almost 30 years, over 30 years now.
Wow.
1986.
Do you remember
32 years, yeah. Right? Nicaragua has never been as prosperous as it was over the last 5 years. Never.
Oh, yeah. And I imagine that the Contra insurgency is still in the living memory, so... You know.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. If you talk to former Contra leaders, they'll say that they are against what's going on at the moment because they recognize that this government has radically transformed Nicaragua's economy for the better, especially in terms of democratization. And just a simple figure. 70% of the population work in small businesses, family businesses, cooperatives, that kind of area. And they generate around 53-54% of GDP. So it's the popular economy here after 10 years of government under the Sandinista president, Daniel Ortega, that is the motor of Nicaragua's economy. It's not the private business sector. And that is something fundamental to understand about Nicaragua's economy. And the business sector are actually a minority contributor to the country's GDP. The main contributors are the popular economy, the associative cooperative economy, small businesses, and the government investment. Those are the main components of GDP.
It's a kind of economy that's not convenient to hegemonic world powers.
Oh, correct. And but there's so many aspects of this that we need to, you know, to understand what's going on here.
Yeah.
You need to look at so many different aspects. And we can just touch on them in the briefest possible way in these conversations.
Yeah, that's true. I did want to get one quick question from about the local media and how that's influencing the situation.
Well, I know the local media here are mostly controlled by the opposition. The two main newspapers are controlled by the opposition, and half the television channels are controlled by the opposition, including a virulently anti-government news channel called 100% Noticias. And so one of the good things that has happened is that the national dialogue is being televised. So ordinary people can see for themselves what the positions of the government are, the various interest groups in Nicaraguan society and economy aligned with the government and the opposition. Now, the key thing that the opposition are refusing to do is that they're refusing to dismantle the roadblocks. And the roadblocks are operated by masked thugs who are armed, and it's like if you get. And do you live in? Is it Toronto that you live in?
I'm based in Winnipeg.
Okay, well, imagine any big city in Canada, and imagine that all the main roads out are blocked by people, masked people carrying weapons, and that the police are off the streets. And imagine that. Well, that's the situation here in Nicaragua.
Well, you know, I really appreciate you because everything that you're saying here has been completely off the mainstream media radar, and I think our listeners are very grateful for your helping shed light on this situation. So I want to thank you very much, Stephen Sefton. And also, if our listeners want to know more, they can check out the website tortillaconsol.com. So thanks, Stephen, for sharing your thoughts with us.
Okay, you're very welcome, Michael. I'm glad you think it was useful.
That was our show for this week. If you like what you heard and value the independent perspectives this radio program brings every week, please consider a generous contribution to stations like CKUW, which air the program, as well as to the Global Research website by visiting globalresearch.ca and clicking Donate on the menu bar. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.